He started from the very beginning, and they listened as they walked. By the time they reached the mudflats, he had reached the point where he and his father were fighting on the mountaintop.
And then the witch killed him.
He had never really understood that. He explained what she'd told him before she killed herself. She had loved John Parry, and he had scorned her.
Witches are fierce, though,
Lyra said.
But if she loved him...
Well,
said Mary.
Love is ferocious, too.
But he loved my mother, and I can tell her that he was never unfaithful.
Lyra, looking at Will, thought that if he fell in love, he would be like that. All around them, the quiet noises of the afternoon hung in the warm air. The endless, trickling, sucking of the marsh, the scraping of insects, the calling of gulls. The tide was fully out, so the whole extent of the beach was clear and glistening under the bright sun. A billion tiny mud creatures lived and ate and died in the top layer of sand, and the little casts and breathing holes and invisible movements showed that the whole landscape was aquiver with life. Without telling the others why, Mary looked out to the distant sea, scanning the horizon for white sails. But there was only hazy glitter where the blue of the sky paled at the edge of the sea, and the sea took up the pallor and made it sparkle through the shimmering air. She showed Will and Lyra how to gather a particular kind of mollusk by finding their breathing tubes just above the sand. The Mulefa loved them, but it was hard for them to move on the sand and gather them. Whenever Mary came to the shore, she harvested as many as she could, and now, with three pairs of hands and eyes at work, there would be a feast. She gave each of them a cloth bag, and they worked as they listened to the next part of the story. Steadily they filled their bags, and Mary led them unobtrusively back to the edge of the marsh, for the tide was turning. The story was taking a long time. They wouldn't get to the world of the dead that day. As they neared the village, Will was telling Mary what he had learned about demons and ghosts. Mary was particularly interested in the three-part nature of human beings.
You know, the church, the Catholic church that I used to belong to, wouldn't use the word demon, but St. Paul talks about spirit and soul and body. So the idea of three parts in human nature isn't so strange.
But the best part is the body. That's what Baruch and Balthamus told me. Angels wish they had bodies. They told me that angels can't understand why we don't enjoy the world more. It would be sort of ecstasy for them to have our flesh and our senses in the world of the dead.
Tell it when we get to it,
said Lyra, and she smiled at him, a smile of such sweet knowledge and joy that his senses felt confused. He smiled back, and Mary thought his expression showed more perfect trust than she'd ever seen on a human face. By this time they had reached the village, and there was the evening meal to prepare. So Mary left the other two by the riverbank, where they sat to watch the tide flooding in, and went to join Atal by the cooking fire. Her friend was overjoyed by the shellfish harvest.
But Mary, the Tualapi destroyed a village farther up the coast, and then another and another. They've never done that before. They usually attack one and then go back to sea. And another tree fell today.
No, where?
Atal mentioned a grove not far from a hot spring. Mary had been there only 3 days before, and nothing had seemed wrong. She took the spyglass and looked at the sky. Sure enough, the great stream of shadow particles was flowing more strongly and at incomparably greater speed and volume than the tide now rising between the riverbanks.
What can you do?
Mary felt the weight of responsibility like a heavy hand between her shoulder blades, but made herself sit up lightly.
Tell them stories, she said.
When supper was over, the three humans and Atal sat on rugs outside Mary's house, under the warm stars. They lay back, well-fed and comfortable in the flower-scented night, and listened to Mary tell her story. She began just before she first met Lyra, telling them about the work she was doing at the Dark Matter Research Group and the funding crisis. How much time she'd had to spend asking for money, and how little time there'd been left for research. But Lyra's coming had changed everything, and so quickly. Within a matter of days, she'd left her world altogether.
I did as you told me. I made a program. That's a set of instructions. To let the shadows talk to me through the computer. They told me what to do. They said they were angels, and, well,
If you were a scientist, I don't suppose that was a good thing for them to say. You might not have believed in angels.
But I knew about them. I used to be a nun, you see. I thought physics could be done to the glory of God, till I saw there wasn't any God at all and that physics was more interesting anyway. The Christian religion is a very powerful and convincing mistake, that's all.
When did you stop being a nun?
I remember it exactly, even to the time of day. Because I was good at physics, they let me keep up my university career, you see, and I finished my doctorate and I was going to teach. It wasn't one of those orders where they shut you away from the world. In fact, we didn't even wear the habit. We just had to dress soberly and wear a crucifix. So I was going into university to teach and do research into particle physics. And there was a conference on my subject, and they asked me to come and read a paper. The conference was in Lisbon, and I'd never been there before. In fact, I'd never been out of England. The whole business, the plane flight, the hotel, the bright sunlight, the foreign languages all around me, the well-known people who were going to speak, and the thought of my own paper, and wondering whether anyone would turn up to listen, and whether I'd be too nervous to get the words out. Oh, I was keyed up with excitement, I can't tell you. And I was so innocent. You have to remember that. I'd been such a good little girl. I'd gone to Mass regularly. I thought I had a vocation for the spiritual life. I wanted to serve God with all my heart. I wanted to take my whole life and offer it up, like this,
she said, holding up her hands together,
and place it in front of Jesus to do as he liked with. And I suppose I was pleased with myself. Too much. I was holy, and I was clever. That lasted until, 9:30 on the evening of August the 10th, 7 years ago.
Lyra sat up and hugged her knees, listening closely.
It was the evening after I'd given my paper, and it had gone well, and there'd been some well-known people listening, and I'd dealt with the questions without making a mess of it, and altogether I was full of relief and pleasure, and pride, too, no doubt. Anyway, some of my colleagues were going to a restaurant a little way down the coast, and they asked if I'd like to go. Normally, I'd have made some excuse, but this time I thought, well, I'm a grown woman. I have presented a paper on an important subject, and it was well received, and I'm among good friends. And it was so warm, and the talk was about all the things I was most interested in, and we were all in high spirits, so I thought I'd loosen up a bit. I was discovering another side of myself, you know, one that liked the taste of wine and grilled sardines and the feeling of warm air on my skin and the beat of music in the background. I relished it. So we sat down to eat in the garden. I was at the end of a long table under a lemon tree, and there was a sort of bower next to me with passion flowers. And my neighbour was talking to the person on the other side, and, well, sitting opposite was a man I'd seen once or twice around the conference. I didn't know him to speak to. He was Italian, and he'd done some work that people were talking about, and I thought it would be interesting to hear about it. Anyway, he was only a little older than me, and he had soft black hair and beautiful olive-coloured skin and dark, dark eyes. His hair kept falling across his forehead, and he kept pushing it back, like that, slowly.
She showed them. Will thought she looked as if she remembered it very well.
He wasn't handsome. He wasn't a ladies' man, or a charmer. If he had been, I'd have been shy. I wouldn't have known how to talk to him. But he was nice and clever, and funny. And it was the easiest thing in the world to sit there in the lantern light under the lemon tree, with the scent of the flowers and the grilled food and the wine, and talk and laugh, and feel myself hoping that he thought I was pretty. Sister Mary Malone flirting. What about my vows? What about dedicating my life to Jesus and all that? Well, I don't know if it was the wine or my own silliness, or the warm air, or the lemon tree, or whatever. But it gradually seemed to me that I'd made myself believe something that wasn't true. I'd made myself believe that I was fine and happy and fulfilled on my own without the love of anyone else. Being in love was like China. You knew it was there, and no doubt it was very interesting, and some people went there, but I never would. I'd spend all my life without ever going to China, but it wouldn't matter because there was all the rest of the world to visit. And then someone passed me a bit of some sweet stuff, and I suddenly realized I had been to China, so to speak, and I'd forgotten it. It was the taste of the sweet stuff that brought it back. I think it was marzipan. Sweet almond paste.
She explained to Lyra, who was looking confused. Lyra said,
Ah, marchpane.
And settled back comfortably to hear what happened next.
Anyway, I remembered the taste, and all at once I was back tasting it for the first time as a young girl. I was 12 years old. I was at a party at the house of one of my friends, a birthday party, and there was a disco. That's where they play music on a kind of recording machine and people dance,
she explained, seeing Lyra's puzzlement.
Usually girls dance together because the boys are too shy to ask them. But this boy, I didn't know him, he asked me to dance. And so we had the first dance, and then the next. And by that time we were talking. And you know what it is when you like someone, you know it at once. Well, I liked him such a lot. And we kept on talking, and then there was a birthday cake. And he took a bit of marzipan, and he just gently put it in my mouth. I remember trying to smile, and blushing, and feeling so foolish. And I fell in love with him just for that, for the gentle way he touched my lips with the marzipan.
As Mary said that, Lyra felt something strange happen to her body. She felt as if she had been handed the key to a great house she hadn't known was there, a house that was somehow inside her. And as she turned the key, she felt other doors opening deep in the darkness and lights coming on. She sat trembling as Mary went on.
And I think it was at that party, or it might have been at another one, that we kissed each other for the first time. It was in a garden, and there was the sound of music from inside, and the quiet and the cool among the trees. And I was aching. All my body was aching for him, and I could tell he felt the same. And we were both almost too shy to move. Almost. But one of us did. And then, without any interval between, it was like a quantum leap. Suddenly, we were kissing each other. And, oh, it was more than China. It was paradise. We saw each other about half a dozen times, no more. And then his parents moved away, and I never saw him again. It was such a sweet time. So short. But there it was. I'd known it. I had been to China.
It was the strangest thing. Lyra knew exactly what she meant. And half an hour earlier, she would have had no idea at all. And inside her, that rich house with all its doors opened and all its rooms lit stood waiting, quiet, expectant.
And at 9:30 in the evening, at that restaurant table in Portugal, someone gave me a piece of marzipan and it all came back. And I thought, am I really going to spend the rest of my life without ever feeling that again? I thought, I want to go to China. It's full of treasures and strangeness and mystery and joy. I thought, will anyone be better off if I go straight back to the hotel and say my prayers and confess to the priest and promise never to fall into temptation again? Would anyone be the better for making me miserable? And the answer came back, no. No one will. There's no one to fret, no one to condemn. No one to bless me for being a good girl, no one to punish me for being wicked. Heaven was empty. I didn't know whether God had died, or whether there never had been a God at all. Either way, I felt free and lonely. and I didn't know whether I was happy or unhappy, but something very strange had happened. And all that huge change came about as I had the marzipan in my mouth before I'd even swallowed it. A taste, a memory, a landslide. When I did swallow it and looked at the man across the table, I could tell he knew something had happened. I couldn't tell him there and then. It was still too strange and private almost for me. But later on, we went for a walk along the beach in the dark, and the warm night breeze kept stirring my hair about, and the Atlantic was being very well behaved, little quiet waves around our feet. And I took the crucifix from around my neck, and I threw it in the sea. That was it. All over. Gone. So that was how I stopped being a nun,
she said.
Was that man the same one that found out about the skulls?
Oh, no, the skull man was Dr. Payne, Oliver Payne. He came along much later. No, the man at the conference was called Alfredo Montale. He was very different.
Did you kiss him?
Well,
said Mary, smiling.
Yes, but not then.
Was it hard to leave the church?
In one way, it was. Because everyone was so disappointed. Everyone from the Mother Superior to the priests to my parents, they were so upset and reproachful. I felt as if something they all passionately believed in depended on me carrying on with something I didn't. But in another way, it was easy, because it made sense. For the first time ever, I felt I was doing something with all of my nature, and not only a part of it. So it was lonely for a while, but then I got used to it.
Did you marry him?
No, I didn't marry anyone. I lived with someone, not Alfredo, someone else. I lived with him for 4 years, nearly. My family was scandalized. But then we decided we'd be happier not living together. So I'm on my own. The man I lived with used to like mountain climbing, and he taught me to climb. And I walk in the mountains, and I've got my work. Well, I had my work. So I'm solitary but happy, if you see what I mean.
What was the boy called at the party?
Tim.
What did he look like?
Oh, nice. That's all I remember.
When I first saw you, in your Oxford, you said one of the reasons you became a scientist was that you wouldn't have to think about good and evil. Did you think about them when you were a nun?
No, but I knew what I should think. It was whatever the church taught me to think. And when I did science, I had to think about other things altogether, so I never had to think about them for myself at all.
But do you now?
I think I have to,
Mary said, trying to be accurate.
When you stopped believing in God, did you stop believing in good and evil?
No, but I stopped believing there was a power of good and a power of evil that were outside us. And I came to believe that good and evil are names for what people do, not for what they are. All we can say is that this is a good deed because it helps someone, or that's an evil one because it hurts them. People are too complicated to have simple labels.
Yes.
Did you miss God?
Yes, terribly. And I still do. And what I miss most is the sense of being connected to the whole of the universe. I used to feel I was connected to God like that. And because he was there, I was connected to the whole of his creation. But if he's not there, then...
Far out on the marshes, a bird called with a long, melancholy series of falling tones. Embers settled in the fire. The grass was stirring faintly with the night breeze. Atal seemed to be dozing like a cat, her wheels flat on the grass beside her, her legs folded under her body, eyes half closed, attention half there and half elsewhere. Will was lying on his back, eyes open to the stars. As for Lyra, she hadn't moved a muscle since that strange thing had happened, and she held the memory of the sensation inside her. She didn't know what it was, or what it meant, or where it had come from, so she sat hugging her knees and tried to stop herself from trembling. Soon, she thought. Soon I'll know. Mary was tired. She had run out of stories. No doubt she'd think of more tomorrow. Chapter 34. There is now.
Show you all alive the world where every particle of dust breathes forth its joy. William Blake.
Mary couldn't sleep. Every time she closed her eyes, something made her sway and lurch as if she were at the brink of a precipice, and she snapped awake, tense with fear. This happened 3, 4, 5 times until she realized that sleep was not going to come. So she got up and dressed quietly, and stepped out of the house and away from the tree with its tent-like branches under which Will and Lyra were sleeping. The moon was bright and high in the sky. There was a lively wind, and the great landscape was mottled with cloud shadows, moving, Mary thought, like the migration of some herd of unimaginable beasts. But animals migrated for a purpose. When you saw herds of reindeer moving across the tundra, or wildebeest crossing the savannah, you knew they were going where the food was, or to places where it was good to mate and bear offspring. Their movement had a meaning. These clouds were moving as the result of pure chance, the effect of utterly random events at the level of atoms and molecules. Their shadows speeding over the grassland had no meaning at all. Nevertheless, they looked as if they did. They looked tense and driven with purpose. The whole night did. Mary felt it too, except that she didn't know what that purpose was. But unlike her, the clouds seemed to know what they were doing and why, and the wind knew, and the grass knew. The entire world was alive and conscious. Mary climbed the slope and looked back across the marshes, where the incoming tide laced a brilliant silver through the glistening dark of the mudflats and the reed beds. The cloud shadows were very clear down there. They looked as if they were fleeing something frightful behind them, or hastening to embrace something wonderful ahead. But what that was, Mary would never know. She turned towards the grove where her climbing tree stood. It was 20 minutes' walk away. She could see it clearly, towering high and tossing its great head in a dialogue with the urgent wind. They had things to say, and she couldn't hear them. She hurried towards it, moved by the excitement of the night, and desperate to join in. This was the very thing she'd told Will about when he asked if she missed God. It was the sense that the whole universe was alive, and that everything was connected to everything else by threads of meaning. When she'd been a Christian, she had felt connected too, but when she left the church she felt loose and free and light in a universe without purpose. And then had come the discovery of the shadows, and her journey into another world, and now this vivid night, and it was plain that everything was throbbing with purpose and meaning, but she was cut off from it. And it was impossible to find a connection, because there was no God. Half in exultation and half in despair, she resolved to climb her tree and try once again to lose herself in the dust. But before she'd even gone halfway to the grove, she heard a different sound among the lashing of the leaves and the streaming of the wind through the grass. Something was groaning, a deep, somber note like an organ. And above that, the sound of cracking, snapping and breaking, and the squeal and scream of wood on wood. Surely it couldn't be her tree. She stopped where she was, in the open grassland, with the wind lashing her face and the cloud shadows racing past her and the tall grasses whipping her thighs, and watched the canopy of the grove. Boughs groaned, twigs snapped, great balks of green wood snapped off like dry sticks and fell all the long way to the ground, and then the crown itself, the crown of the very tree she knew so well, leaned and leaned and slowly began to topple. Every fiber in the trunk, the bark, the roots seemed to cry out separately against this murder. But it fell and fell. All the great length of it smashed its way out of the grove and seemed to lean towards Mary before crashing into the ground like a wave against a breakwater. And the colossal trunk rebounded up a little way and settled down finally with a groaning of torn wood. She ran up to touch the tossing leaves. There was her rope. There were the splintered ruins of her platform. Her heart thudding painfully, she climbed in among the fallen branches, hauling herself through the familiar boughs at their unfamiliar angles, and balanced herself as high up as she could get. She braced herself against a branch and took out the spyglass. Through it, she saw 2 quite different movements in the sky. One was that of the clouds, driven across the moon in one direction, and the other was that of the stream of dust, seeming to cross it in quite another. And of the 2, the dust was flowing more quickly and at much greater volume. In fact, the whole sky seemed to be flowing with it, a great inexorable flood pouring out of the world, out of all the worlds, into some ultimate emptiness. Slowly, as if they were moving themselves in her mind, things joined up. Will and Lyra had said that the subtle knife was 300 years old at least, so the old man in the tower had told them. The Mulefa had told her that the Sraf, which had nurtured their lives and their world for 33,000 years, had begun to fail just over 300 years ago. According to Will, the guild of the Torre degli Angeli, the owners of the subtle knife, had been careless. They hadn't always closed the windows they opened. Well, Mary had found one after all, and there must be many others. Suppose that all this time, little by little, dust had been leaking out of the wounds the subtle knife had made in nature. She felt dizzy, and it wasn't only the swaying and rising and falling of the branches she was wedged among. She put the spyglass carefully in her pocket and hooked her arms over the branch in front, gazing at the sky, the moon, the scudding clouds. The subtle knife was responsible for the small-scale, low-level leakage. It was damaging, and the universe was suffering because of it, and she must talk to Will and Lyra and find a way to stop it. But the vast flood in the sky was another matter entirely. That was new, and it was catastrophic, and if it wasn't stopped, all conscious life would come to an end. As the Mulefa had shown her, dust came into being when living things became conscious of themselves, but it needed some feedback system to reinforce it and make it safe, as the Mulefa had their wheels and the oil from the trees. Without something like that, it would all vanish. Thought, imagination, feeling would all wither and blow away, leaving nothing but a brutish automatism. And that brief period when life was conscious of itself would flicker out like a candle in every one of the billions of worlds where it had burned brightly. Mary felt the burden of it keenly. It felt like age. She felt 80 years old, worn out and weary and longing to die. She climbed heavily out of the branches of the great fallen tree, and with the wind still wild in the leaves and the grass in her hair, set off back to the village. At the summit of the slope, she looked for the last time at the dust stream, with the clouds and the wind blowing across it and the moon standing firm in the middle. And then she saw what they were doing at last. She saw what that great urgent purpose was. They were trying to hold back the dust flood. They were striving to put some barriers up against the terrible stream. Wind, moon, clouds, leaves, grass, all those lovely things were crying out and hurling themselves into the struggle to keep the shadow particles in this universe, which they so enriched. Matter loved dust. It didn't want to see it go. That was the meaning of this night, and it was Mary's meaning too. Had she thought there was no meaning in life, no purpose, when God had gone? Yes, she had thought that.
Well, there is now. There is now.
As she looked again at the clouds and the moon in the dust flow, they looked as frail and doomed as a dam of little twigs and tiny pebbles trying to hold back the Mississippi. But they were trying all the same. They'd go on trying till the end of everything. How long she stayed out, Mary didn't know. When the intensity of her feeling began to subside, and exhaustion took its place, she made her way slowly down the hill toward the village. And when she was halfway down, near a little grove of knotwood bushes, she saw something strange out on the mudflats. There was a glow of white, a steady movement, something coming up with the tide. She stood still, gazing intently. It couldn't be the Tualapi, because they always moved in a flock, and this was on its own. But everything about it was the same, the sail-like wings, the long neck. It was one of the birds, no doubt about it. She had never heard of their moving about alone, and she hesitated before running down to warn the villagers, because the thing had stopped in any case. It was floating on the water close to the path. And it was coming apart. No, something was getting off its back. The something was a man. She could see him quite clearly, even at that distance. The moonlight was brilliant and her eyes were adjusted to it. She looked through the spyglass and put the matter beyond doubt. It was a human figure, radiating dust. He was carrying something, a long stick of some kind. He came along the path quickly and easily, not running but moving like an athlete or a hunter. He was dressed in simple dark clothes that would normally conceal him well, but through the spyglass he showed up as if he were under a spotlight. And as he came closer to the village, She realized what that stick was. He was carrying a rifle. She felt as if someone had poured icy water over her heart. Every separate hair on her flesh stirred. She was too far away to do anything. Even if she'd shouted, he wouldn't have heard. She had to watch as he stepped into the village, looking to the left and right, stopping every so often to listen, moving from house to house. Mary's mind felt like the moon and the clouds trying to hold back the dust as she cried out silently, "Don't look under the tree! Go away from the tree!" But he moved closer and closer to it, finally stopping outside her own house. She couldn't bear it. She put the spyglass in her pocket and began to run down the slope. She was about to call out anything, a wild cry, but just in time she realized that it might wake Will or Lyra and make them reveal themselves, and she choked it back. Then, because she couldn't bear not knowing what the man was doing, she stopped and fumbled for the spyglass again and had to stand still while she looked through it. He was opening the door of her house. He was going inside it. He vanished from sight, although there was a stir in the dust he left behind, like smoke when a hand is passed through it. Mary waited for an endless minute, and then he appeared again. He stood in her doorway, looking around slowly from left to right, and his gaze swept past the tree. Then he stepped off the threshold and stood still, almost at a loss. Mary was suddenly conscious of how exposed she was on the bare hillside, an easy rifle shot away, but he was only interested in the village. And when another minute or so had gone by, he turned and walked quietly away. She watched every step he took down the river path, and saw quite clearly how he stepped onto the bird's back and sat cross-legged as it turned to glide away. 5 minutes later, they were lost to sight. Chapter 35. Over the Hills and Far Away.
The birthday of my life is come. My love is come to me. Christina Rossetti.
Dr. Malone,
said Lyra in the morning.
Will and me have got to look for our demons. When we found them, we'll know what to do. But we can't be without them for much longer, so we just want to go and look.
Where will you go?
Said Mary, heavy-eyed and headachy after her disturbed night. She and Lyra were on the river bank, Lyra to wash, and Mary to look surreptitiously for the man's footprints. So far, she hadn't found any.
Don't know, but they're out there somewhere. As soon as we came through from the battle, they ran away as if they didn't trust us anymore. Can't say I blame them either. But we know they're in this world, and we thought we saw them a couple of times, so maybe we can find them.
Listen,
Mary said reluctantly, and told Lyra about the man she'd seen the night before. As she spoke, Will came to join them, and both he and Lyra listened, wide-eyed and serious.
He's probably just a traveller, and he found a window and wandered through from somewhere else,
Lyra said when Mary had finished.
Like Will's father did. There's bound to be all kinds of openings now. Anyway, if he just turned around and left, he can't have meant to do anything bad, can he?
I don't know. I didn't like it. And I'm worried about you going off on your own. Or I would be if I didn't know you'd already done far more dangerous things than that. Oh, I don't know. But please be careful. Please look all around. At least out on the prairie, you can see someone coming from a long way off.
If we do, we can escape straight away into another world, so he won't be able to hurt us.
They were determined to go, and Mary was reluctant to argue.
At least promise that you won't go in among the trees. If that man is still around, he might be hiding in a wood or a grove, and you wouldn't see him in time to escape.
We promise.
Well, I'll pack you some food in case you're out all day.
Mary took some flat bread and cheese, and some sweet, thirst-quenching red fruits, wrapped them in a cloth, and tied a cord around it for one of them to carry over a shoulder.
Good hunting,
she said as they left.
Please take care.
She was still anxious. She stood watching them all the way to the foot of the slope.
I wonder why she's so sad,
Will said as he and Lyra climbed the road up to the ridge.
She's probably wondering if she'll ever go home again, and if her laboratory will still be hers when she does. And maybe she's sad about the man she was in love with.
Do you think we'll ever go home?
Dunno. I don't suppose I've got a home anyway. They probably couldn't have me back at Jordan College, and I can't live with the bears or the witches. Maybe I could live with Egyptians. I wouldn't mind that, if they'd have me.
What about Lord Asriel's world? Wouldn't you want to live there?
It's going to fail, remember?
Why?
Because of what your father's ghost said, just before we came out. About demons, and how they can only live for a long time if they stay in their own world. But probably Lord Asriel, I mean my father, couldn't have thought about that because no one knew enough about other worlds when he started. All that bravery and skill, all that, all wasted, all for nothing.
They climbed on, finding the going easy on the rock road, and when they reached the top of the ridge, they stopped and looked back.
Will, supposing we don't find them?
I'm sure we will. What I'm wondering is what my demon will be like.
You saw her, and I picked her up,
Lyra said, blushing, because of course it was a gross violation of manners to touch something so private as someone else's demon. It was forbidden not only by politeness, but by something deeper than that, something like shame. A quick glance at Will's warm cheeks showed that he knew that just as well as she did. They walked on side by side, suddenly shy with each other. But Will, not put off by being shy, said,
When does your demon stop changing shape?
About, I suppose about our age, or a bit older, maybe more sometimes. We used to talk about Pan settling, him and me. We used to wonder what he'd be.
Don't people have any idea?
Not when they're young. As you grow up, you start thinking, well, they might be this or they might be that. And usually they end up something that fits. I mean, something like your real nature. Like, if your demon's a dog, that means you like doing what you're told and knowing who's boss and following orders and pleasing people who are in charge. A lot of servants are people whose demons are dogs. So it helps to know what you're like and to find what you'd be good at. How do people in your world know what they're like?
I don't know. I don't know much about my world. All I know is keeping secret and quiet and hidden. So I don't know much about grown-ups and friends or lovers. I think it'd be difficult having a demon, because everybody would know so much about you just by looking. I like to keep secret and stay out of sight.
Then maybe your demon would be an animal that's good at hiding. Or one of those animals that looks like another. A butterfly that looks like a wasp for disguise. They must have creatures like that in your world, because we have. And we're so much alike.
They walked on together in a friendly silence. All around them, the wide, clear morning lay limpid in the hollows and pearly blue in the warm air above. As far as the eye could see, the great savannah rolled, brown, gold, buff green, shimmering towards the horizon, and empty. They might have been the only people in the world.
But it's not empty, really.
You mean that man?
No. You know what I mean.
Yes, I do. I can see shadows in the grass. Maybe birds,
Will said. He was following the little darting movements here and there. He found it easier to see the shadows if he didn't look at them. They were more willing to show themselves to the corners of his eye. And when he said so to Lyra, she said,
It's negative capability.
What's that?
The poet Keats said it first. Dr. Malone knows. It's how I read the alethiometer. It's how you use the knife, isn't it?
Yes, I suppose it is. But I was just thinking that they might be the demons.
So was I. But...
She put her finger to her lips. He nodded.
Look, there's one of those fallen trees.
It was Mary's climbing tree. They went up to it carefully, keeping an eye on the grove in case another one should fall. In the calm morning, with only a faint breeze stirring the leaves, it seemed impossible that a mighty thing like this should ever topple, but here it was. The vast trunk, supported in the grove by its torn-up roots and out on the grass by the mass of branches, was high above their heads. Some of those branches, crushed and broken, were themselves as big around as the biggest trees Will had ever seen. The crown of the tree, tight-packed with boughs that still looked sturdy, leaves that were still green, towered like a ruined palace into the mild air. Suddenly Lyra gripped Will's arm.
Shh! Don't look. I'm sure they're up there. I saw something move, and I swear it was Pan.
Her hand was warm. He was more aware of that than of the great mass of leaves and branches above them. Pretending to gaze vacantly at the horizon, he let his attention wander upwards into the confused mass of green, brown, and blue, and there, she was right. There was a something that was not the tree. And beside it, another.
Walk away. We'll go somewhere else and see if they follow us.
Suppose they don't. But yes, all right.
They pretended to look all around. They set their hands on one of the branches resting on the ground as if they were intending to climb. They pretended to change their minds by shaking their heads and walking away.
I wish we could look behind,
Lyra said when they were a few hundred yards away.
Just go on walking. They can see us and they won't get lost. They'll come to us when they want to.
They stepped off the black road and into the knee-high grass, swishing their legs through the stems, watching the insects hovering, darting, fluttering, skimming, hearing the million-voiced chorus chirrup and scrape.
What are you going to do, Will?
Lyra said after they'd walked some way in silence.
Well, I've got to go home.
She thought he sounded unsure, though. She hoped he sounded unsure.
But they might still be after you, those men.
We've seen worse than them after all.
Yes, I suppose. But I wanted to show you Jordan College and the fens. I wanted us to...
Yeah, and I wanted... It would be good to go to Chittagatse again, even. It was a beautiful place. And if the spectres are all gone... But there's my mother. I've got to go back and look after her. I just left her with Mrs. Cooper, and it's not fair on either of them.
But it's not fair on you to have to do that.
No, but that's a different sort of not fair. That's just like an earthquake or a rainstorm. It might not be fair, but no one's to blame. But if I just leave my mother with an old lady who isn't very well herself, then that's a different kind of not fair. That would be wrong. I've just got to go home. But probably it's going to be difficult to go back as we were. Probably the secret's out now. I don't suppose Mrs. Cooper will have been able to look after her. Not if my mother's in one of those times when she gets frightened of things. So she's probably had to get help, and when I go back, I'll be made to go into some kind of institution.
No! Like an orphanage!
I think that's what they do. I just don't know. I'll hate it.
You could escape with the knife, Will. You could come to my world.
I still belong there, where I can be with her. When I'm grown up, I'll be able to look after her properly, in my own house. No one can interfere then.
Do you think you'll get married?
He was quiet for a long time. She knew he was thinking, though.
I can't see that far ahead. It would have to be someone who understands about... I don't think there's anyone like that in my world. Would you get married?
Me too. Not to anyone in my world, I shouldn't think.
They walked on steadily, wandering towards the horizon. They had all the time in the world, all the time the world had. After a while, Lyra said,
You will keep the knife, won't you? So you could visit my world?
Of course. I certainly wouldn't give it to anyone else, ever.
Don't look,
she said, not altering her pace.
There they are again, on the left.
They are following us.
Shh.
I thought they would. Okay, we'll just pretend now. We'll just wander along as if we're looking for them, and we'll look in all sorts of stupid places.
It became a game. They found a pond and searched among the reeds and in the mud, saying loudly that the demons were bound to be shaped like frogs or water beetles or slugs. They peeled off the bark of a long fallen tree at the edge of a stringwood grove, pretending to have seen the two demons creeping underneath it in the form of earwigs. Lyra made a great fuss of an ant she claimed to have trodden on, sympathizing with its bruises, saying its face was just like Pan's, asking in mock sorrow why it was refusing to speak to her. But when she thought they were genuinely out of earshot, she said earnestly to Will, leaning close to speak quietly,
We had to leave them, didn't we? We didn't have a choice, really.
Yes, we had to. It was worse for you than for me, but we didn't have any choice at all, because you made a promise to Roger and you had to keep it.
And you had to speak to your father again.
And we had to let them all out.
Yes, we did. I'm so glad we did. Pan will be glad one day too, when I die. We won't be split up. It was a good thing we did.
As the sun rose higher in the sky and the air became warmer, they began to look for shade. Towards noon they found themselves on the slope rising towards the summit of a ridge, and when they'd reached it, Lyra flopped down on the grass.
Well, if we don't find somewhere shady soon...
There was a valley leading down on the other side, and it was thick with bushes, so they guessed there might be a stream as well. They traversed the slope of the ridge till it dipped into the head of the valley, and there, sure enough, among ferns and reeds, a spring bubbled out of the rock. They dipped their hot faces in the water and swallowed gratefully, and then they followed the stream downwards, seeing it gather in miniature whirlpools and pour over tiny ledges of stone, and all the time get fuller and wider.
How does it do that? There's no more water coming into it from anywhere else, but there's so much more of it here than up there.
Will, watching the shadows out of the corner of his eye, saw them slip ahead, leaping over the ferns to disappear into the bushes further down. He pointed silently.
It just goes slower. It doesn't flow as fast as the spring comes out, so it gathers in these pools. They've gone in there,
he whispered, indicating a little group of trees at the foot of the slope. They looked at each other, a curiously formal and serious look, before setting off to follow the stream. The undergrowth got thicker as they went down the valley. The stream went into tunnels of green and emerged in dappled clearings, only to tumble over a lip of stone and bury itself in the green again, and they had to follow it as much by hearing as by sight. At the foot of the hill, it ran into the little wood of silver-barked trees. Father Gomez watched from the top of the ridge. It hadn't been hard to follow them. Despite Mary's confidence in the open savannah, there was plenty of concealment in the grass and the occasional thickets of stringwood and saplacker bushes. The two young people had spent a lot of time earlier looking all around as if they thought they were being followed. He had had to keep some distance away, but as the morning passed, they became more and more absorbed in each other and paid less attention to the landscape. The one thing he didn't want to do was hurt the boy. He had a horror of harming an innocent person. The only way to make sure of his target was to get close enough to see her clearly, which meant following them into the wood. Quietly and cautiously he moved down the course of the stream. His demon, the green-backed beetle, flew overhead, tasting the air. Her eyesight was less good than his, but her sense of smell was acute, and she caught the scent of the young people's flesh very clearly. She would go a little ahead, perch on a stem of grass, and wait for him, then move on again. And as she caught the trail in the air that their bodies left behind, Father Gomez found himself praising God for his mission, because it was clearer than ever that the boy and the girl were walking into mortal sin. He watched them go in among the trees. They hadn't looked back once since coming over the top of the ridge, but he still kept low, moving down the stream at a crouch, holding the rifle in one hand, balancing with the other. He was so close to success now that for the first time he found himself speculating on what he would do afterwards, and whether he would please the kingdom of heaven more by going back to Geneva or staying to evangelize this world. The first thing to do here would be to convince the four-legged creatures, who seemed to have the rudiments of reason, that their habit of riding on wheels was abominable and satanic and contrary to the will of God. Break them of that, and salvation would follow. He reached the foot of the slope, where the trees began, and laid the rifle down silently. He gazed into the silver-green-gold shadows and listened, with both hands behind his ears to catch and focus any quiet voices through the insect chirping and the trickle of the stream. Yes, there they were. They'd stopped. He bent to pick up the rifle and found himself uttering a hoarse and breathless gasp as something clutched his demon and pulled her away from him. But there was nothing there. Where was she? The pain was atrocious. He heard her crying and cast about wildly to left and right, looking for her.
Keep still,
said a voice from the air.
And be quiet. I have your demon in my hand.
But where are you? Who are you?
My name is Balthamos.
Will and Lyra followed the stream into the wood, walking carefully, saying little, until they were in the very centre. There was a little clearing in the middle of the grove, which was floored with soft grass and moss-covered rocks. The branches laced across overhead, almost shutting out the sky and letting through little moving spangles and sequins of sunlight, so that everything was dappled with gold and silver. And it was quiet. Only the trickle of the stream and the occasional rustle of leaves high up in a little curl of breeze broke the silence. Will put down the package of food. Lyra put down her little rucksack. There was no sign of the demon shadows anywhere. They were completely alone. They took off their shoes and socks and sat down on the mossy rocks at the edge of the stream, dipping their feet in the cold water and feeling the shock of it invigorate their blood.
I'm hungry.
Me too,
said Lyra, though she was also feeling more than that, something subdued and pressing and half happy and half painful, so that she wasn't quite sure what it was. They unfolded the cloth and ate some bread and cheese. For some reason their hands were slow and clumsy, and they hardly tasted the food, although the bread was floury and crisp from the hot baking stones, and the cheese was flaky and salty and very fresh. Then Lyra took one of those little red fruits. With a fast-beating heart, she turned to him and said,
Will.
And she lifted the fruit gently to his mouth. She could see from his eyes that he knew at once what she meant, and that he was too joyful to speak. Her fingers were still at his lips, and he felt them tremble, and he put his own hand up to hold hers there, and then neither of them could look, They were confused. They were brimming with happiness. Like two moths clumsily bumping together, with no more weight than that, their lips touched. Then, before they knew how it happened, they were clinging together, blindly pressing their faces towards each other.
Like Mary said, you know straight away when you like someone. When you were asleep, on the mountain before she took you away, I told Pan...
I heard. I was awake, and I wanted to tell you the same. And now I know what I must have felt all the time. I love you, Will. I love you.
The word love set his nerves ablaze. All his body thrilled with it, and he answered her in the same words, kissing her hot face over and over again, drinking in with adoration the scent of her body and her warm, honey-fragrant hair, and her sweet, moist mouth that tasted of the little red fruit. Around them there was nothing but silence, as if all the world were holding its breath. Balthamos was terrified. He moved up the stream and away from the wood, holding the scratching, stinging, biting insect demon, and trying to conceal himself as much as he could from the man who was stumbling after them. He mustn't let him catch up. He knew that Father Gomez would kill him in a moment. An angel of his rank was no match for a man, even if that angel was strong and healthy, and Balthamos was neither of those. Besides which, he was crippled by grief over Baruch and shame at having deserted Will before. He no longer even had the strength to fly.
Stop! Stop!
Said Father Gomez.
Please keep still. I can't see you. Let's talk, please. Don't hurt my demon, I beg you.
In fact, the demon was hurting Balthamos. The angel could see the little green thing dimly through the backs of his clasped hands, and she was sinking her powerful jaws again and again into his palms. If he opened his hands just for a moment, she would be gone. Balthamos kept them closed.
This way. Follow me. Come away from the wood. I want to talk to you, and this is the wrong place.
But who are you? I can't see you. Come closer. How can I tell what you are till I see you? Keep still, don't move so quickly!
But moving quickly was the only defense Balthamos had. Trying to ignore the stinging demon, he picked his way up the little gully where the stream ran, stepping from rock to rock. Then he made a mistake. Trying to look behind him, he slipped and put a foot into the water.
Ah!
Came a whisper of satisfaction as Father Gomez saw the splash. Balthamos withdrew his foot at once and hurried on, but now a wet print appeared on the dry rocks each time he put his foot down. The priest saw it and leapt forward and felt the brush of feathers on his hand. He stopped in astonishment. The word angel reverberated in his mind. Balthamos seized the moment to stumble forward again, and the priest felt himself dragged after him as another brutal pang wrenched his heart. Balthamos said over his shoulder,
"A little further, just to the top of the ridge, and we shall talk, I promise."
"Talk here! Stop where you are, and I swear I shan't touch you!"
The angel didn't reply. It was too hard to concentrate. He had to split his attention three ways, behind him to avoid the man, ahead to see where he was going, and on the furious demon tormenting his hands. As for the priest, his mind was working quickly. A truly dangerous opponent would have killed his demon at once and ended the matter there and then. This antagonist was afraid to strike. With that in mind, he let himself stumble and uttered little moans of pain and pleaded once or twice for the other to stop, all the time watching closely, moving nearer, estimating how big the other was, how quickly he could move, which way he was looking.
"Please, you don't know how much this hurts. I can't do you any harm. Please, can we stop and talk?"
He didn't want to move out of sight of the wood. They were now at the point where the stream began, and he could see the shape of Balthamos's feet very lightly pressing the grass. The priest had watched every inch of the way, and he was sure now where the angel was standing. Balthamos turned around. The priest raised his eyes to the place where he thought the angel's face would be, and saw him for the first time, just a shimmer in the air, but there was no mistaking it. The angel wasn't quite close enough to reach in one movement, though, and in truth the pull on his demon had been painful and weakening. Maybe he should take another step or two.
"Sit down,"
said Balthamos.
"Sit down where you are, not a step closer."
"What do you want?"
said Father Gomez, not moving.
"What do I want? I want to kill you, but I haven't got the strength."
"But are you an angel?"
"What does it matter?"
"You might have made a mistake. We might be on the same side."
"No, we're not. I've been following you. I know whose side you're on. No, no, don't move. Stay there."
"It's not too late to repent. Even angels are allowed to do that. Let me hear your confession."
"Oh, Baruch, help me,"
cried Balthamos in despair, turning away. And as he cried out, Father Gomez leapt for him. His shoulder hit the angel's and knocked Balthamos off balance, and in throwing out a hand to save himself, the angel let go of the insect demon. The beetle flew free at once, and Father Gomez felt a surge of relief and strength. In fact, it was that which killed him, to his great surprise. He hurled himself so hard at the faint form of the angel, and he expected so much more resistance than he met, that he couldn't keep his balance. His foot slipped, his momentum carried him down towards the stream, and Balthamos, thinking of what Baruch would have done, kicked aside the priest's hand as he flung it out for support. Father Gomez fell hard, his head cracked against a stone, and he fell stunned with his face in the water. The cold shock woke him at once, but as he choked and feebly tried to rise, Balthamos, desperate, ignored the demon stinging his face and his eyes and his mouth, and used all the little weight he had to hold the man's head down in the water, and he kept it there, and kept it there, and kept it there. When the demon suddenly vanished, Balthamos let go. The man was dead. As soon as he was sure, Balthamos hauled the body out of the stream and laid it carefully on the grass, folding the priest's hands over his breast and closing his eyes. Then Balthamos stood up, sick and weary and full of pain.
Baruch, oh Baruch, my dear, I can do no more. Will and the girl are safe, and everything will be well. But this is the end for me. Though truly I died when you did, Baruch, my beloved.
A moment later, he was gone. In the bean field, drowsy in the late afternoon heat, Mary heard Atal's voice, and she couldn't tell excitement from alarm. Had another tree fallen? Had the man with the rifle appeared?
Look! Look!
Atal was saying, nudging Mary's pocket with her trunk. So Mary took the spyglass and did as her friend said, pointing it up to the sky.
Tell me what it's doing,
said Atal.
I can feel it is different, but I can't see.
The terrible flood of dust in the sky had stopped flowing. It wasn't still by any means. Mary scanned the whole sky with the amber lens, seeing a current here, an eddy there, a vortex further off. It was in perpetual movement, but it wasn't flowing away anymore. In fact, if anything, it was falling like snowflakes. She thought of the wheel trees, the flowers that opened upwards would be drinking in this golden rain. Mary could almost feel them welcoming it in their poor, parched throats, which were so perfectly shaped for it, and which had been starved for so long.
The young ones,
said Atal. Mary turned, spyglass in hand, to see Will and Lyra returning. They were some way off. They weren't hurrying. They were holding hands, talking together, heads close, oblivious to everything else. She could see that even from a distance. She nearly put the spyglass to her eye, but held back and returned it to her pocket. There was no need for the glass. She knew what she would see. They would seem to be made of living gold. They would seem the true image of what human beings always could be, once they had come into their inheritance. The dust pouring down from the stars had found a living home again, and these children no longer children, saturated with love, were the cause of it all. Chapter 36 The Broken Arrow.
But fate does iron wedges drive, and always crowds itself betwixt. Andrew Marvel.
The two demons moved through the silent village, in and out of the shadows, padding cat-formed across the moonlit gathering floor, pausing outside the open door of Mary's house. Cautiously they looked inside and saw only the sleeping woman, so they withdrew and moved through the moonlight again, towards the shelter tree. Its long branches trailed their fragrant corkscrew leaves almost down to the ground. Very slowly, very careful not to rustle a leaf or snap a fallen twig, the two shapes slipped in through the leaf curtain and saw what they were seeking. The boy and the girl, fast asleep in each other's arms. They moved closer over the grass and touched the sleepers softly with nose, paw, whiskers, bathing in the life-giving warmth they gave off, but being infinitely careful not to wake them. As they checked their people, gently cleaning Will's fast-healing wound, lifting the lock of hair off Lyra's face, there was a soft sound behind them. Instantly, in total silence, both demons sprang around, becoming wolves, mad light eyes, bare white teeth, menace in every line. a woman stood there, outlined by the moon. It was not Mary, and when she spoke they heard her clearly, though her voice made no sound.
"Come with me,"
she said. Pantalaimon's demon heart leapt within him, but he said nothing until he could greet her away from the sleepers under the tree.
"Seraphina Pecola, where have you been? Do you know what's happened?"
"Hush. Let's fly to a place where we can talk,"
she said, mindful of the sleeping villagers. Her branch of cloud pine lay by the door of Mary's house, and as she took it up, the two demons changed into birds, a nightingale, an owl, and flew with her over the thatched roofs, over the grasslands, over the ridge, and towards the nearest wheel tree grove, as huge as a castle, its crown looking like curds of silver in the moonlight. There Seraphina Pecola settled on the highest comfortable branch, among the open flowers drinking in the dust, and the two birds perched nearby.
"You won't be birds for long. Very soon now, your shapes will settle. Look around and take this sight into your memory."
"What will we be?"
said Pantalaimon.
"You'll find out sooner than you think. Listen, and I'll tell you some witch lore that none but witches know. The reason I can do that is that you are here with me, and your humans are down there, sleeping. Who are the only people for whom that is possible?"
"Witches and shamans. So
in leaving you both on the shores of the world of the dead, Lyra and Will did something, without knowing it, that witches have done since the first time there were witches. There's a region of our Northland, a desolate, abominable place, where a great catastrophe happened in the childhood of the world, and where nothing has lived since. No demons can enter it. To become a witch, a girl must cross it alone and leave her demon behind. You know the suffering they must undergo. But having done it, they find that their demons were not severed, as in Bolvanga. They are still one whole being. But now they can roam free and go to far places and see strange things and bring back knowledge. And you are not severed, are you?"
"No, we are still one. But it was so painful, and we were so frightened."
"Well, the two of them will not fly like witches, and they will not live as long as we do. But thanks to what they did, you and they are witch in all but that."
The two demons considered the strangeness of this knowledge.
"Does that mean we shall be birds? Like witches' demons?"
"Be patient."
"And how can Will be a witch? I thought all witches were female."
"Those two have changed many things. We are all learning new ways, even witches. But one thing hasn't changed. You must help your humans, not hinder them. You must help them and guide them and encourage them towards wisdom. That's what demons are for."
They were silent. Seraphina turned to the nightingale.
"What is your name?"
"I have no name. I didn't know I was born until I was torn away from his heart."
"Then I shall name you Kiryava."
"Kiryava,"
said Pantalaimon, trying the sound.
"What does it mean?"
"Soon you will see what it means. But now you must listen carefully, because I'm going to tell you what you should do."
"No,"
said Kiryava.
"I can hear from your tone that you know what I'm going to say."
"We don't want to hear it."
"It's too soon. It's much too soon."
Seraphina was silent because she agreed with them, and she felt sorrowful. She was the wisest one there, and she had to guide them to what was right. But she let their agitation subside before she went on.
"Where did you go in your wanderings?"
"Through many worlds. Everywhere we found a window, we went through. There are more windows than we thought."
"And you saw?"
"Yes. We looked closely, and we saw what was happening."
"We saw many other things. We met an angel, and we saw the world where the little people come from, the Galavespians. There are big people there, too, who try and kill them."
They told the witch more of what they'd seen, and they were trying to distract her, and she knew it. But she let them talk because of the love each one had for the other's voice. But eventually they ran out of things to tell her, and they fell silent. The only sound was the gentle, endless whisper of the leaves.
"You have been keeping away from Will and Lyra to punish them. I know why you're doing that.
My Kaiser did just the same after I came through the desolate barrens. But he came to me eventually because we loved each other still. And they will need you soon to help them do what has to be done next. Because you have to tell them what you know.
Pantalaimon cried aloud, a pure cold owl cry, a sound never heard in that world before. In nests and burrows for a long way around, and wherever any small night creature was hunting or grazing or scavenging, a new and unforgettable fear came into being. Serafina watched from close by and felt nothing but compassion until she looked at Will's demon, Kiriava the Nightingale. She remembered talking to the witch Rutaskadi, who had asked, after seeing Will only once, if Serafina had looked into his eyes, and Serafina had replied that she had not dared to. This little brown bird was radiating an implacable ferocity as palpable as heat, and Serafina was afraid of it. Finally, Pantalaimon's wild screaming died away, and Kiriava said,
"And we have to tell them."
"Yes, you do."
Gradually, the ferocity left the gaze of the little brown bird, and Serafina could look at her again. She saw a desolate sadness in its place.
"There is a ship coming. I left it to fly here and find you. I came with the Egyptians, all the way from our world. They will be here in another day or so."
The two birds sat close, and in a moment they had changed their forms, becoming two doves.
"This may be the last time you fly. I can see a little ahead. I can see that you will both be able to climb this high as long as there are trees this size. But I think you will not be birds when your forms settle. Take in all that you can, and remember it well. I know that you and Lyra and Will are going to think hard and painfully, and I know you will make the best choice. But it is yours to make, and no one else's."
They didn't speak. She took her branch of cloud pine and lifted away from the towering treetops, circling high above, feeling on her skin the coolness of the breeze and the tingle of the starlight, and the benevolent sifting of that dust she had never seen. She flew down to the village once more and went silently into the woman's house. She knew nothing about Mary except that she came from the same world as Will, and that her part in the events was crucial. Whether she was fierce or friendly, Serafina had no way of telling, but she had to wake Mary up without startling her, and there was a spell for that. She sat on the floor at the woman's head and watched through half-closed eyes, breathing in and out in time with her. Presently her half-vision began to show her the pale forms that Mary was seeing in her dreams, and she adjusted her mind to resonate with them, as if she were tuning a string. Then, with a further effort, Serafina herself stepped in among them. Once she was there, she could speak to Mary, and she did so with the instant, easy affection that we sometimes feel for people we meet in dreams. A moment later they were talking together in a murmured rush of which Mary later remembered nothing, and walking through a silly landscape of reed beds and electrical transformers. It was time for Serafina to take charge.
"In a few moments, you'll wake up. Don't be alarmed. You'll find me beside you. I'm waking you like this, so you'll know it's quite safe and there's nothing to hurt you. And then we can talk properly."
She withdrew, taking the dream Mary with her, until she found herself in the house again, cross-legged on the earthen floor, with Mary's eyes glittering as they looked at her.
"You must be the witch."
"I am. My name is Serafina Pekala. What are you called?"
"Mary Malone. I've never been woken so quietly. Am I awake?"
"Yes. We must talk together. And dream talk is hard to control and harder to remember. It's better to talk awake. Do you prefer to stay inside, or will you walk with me in the moonlight?"
"I'll come,"
said Mary, sitting up and stretching.
"Where are the others?"
"Asleep under the tree."
They moved out of the house and past the tree with its curtain of all concealing leaves, and walked down to the river. Mary watched Serafina Pekala with a mixture of wariness and admiration. She had never seen a human form so slender and graceful. She seemed younger than Mary herself, though Lyra had said she was hundreds of years old. The only hint of age came in her expression, which was full of a complicated sadness. They sat on the bank over the silver-black water, and Serafina told her that she had spoken to the children's demons.
"They went looking for them today,"
But something else happened. Will's never seen his demon. He didn't know for certain that he had one.
Well, he has. And so have you.
Mary stared at her.
If you could see him, you would see a black bird with red legs and a bright yellow beak, slightly curved. A bird of the mountains.
An alpine chough. How can you see him?
With my eyes half closed, I can see him. If we had time, I could teach you to see him too, and to see the demons of others in your world. It's strange for us to think you can't see them.
Then she told Mary what she had said to the demons, and what it meant.
And the demons will have to tell them.
I thought of waking them to tell them myself. I thought of telling you and letting you have the responsibility. But I saw their demons, and I knew that would be best.
They're in love.
I know.
They've only just discovered it.
Mary tried to take in all the implications of what Serafina had told her, but it was too hard.
Can you see dust?
No, I've never seen it. And until the wars began, we had never heard of it.
Mary took the spyglass from her pocket and handed it to the witch. Serafina put it to her eye and gasped.
That is dust. It's beautiful.
Turn to look back at the shelter tree.
Serafina did.
They did this.
Something happened today, or yesterday if it's after midnight,
Mary said, trying to find the words to explain, and remembering her vision of the dust flow as a great river like the Mississippi.
Something tiny but crucial. If you wanted to divert a mighty river into a different course, and all you had was a single pebble, you could do it as long as you put the pebble in the right place to send the first trickle of water that way instead of this. Something like that happened yesterday. I don't know what it was. They saw each other differently or something. Until then, they hadn't felt like that, but suddenly they did, and then the dust was attracted to them very powerfully, and it stopped flowing the other way.
So that was how it was to happen. And now it's safe. Or it will be when the angels fill the great chasm in the underworld.
She told Mary about the abyss, and about how she herself had found out.
I was flying high, looking for a landfall, and I met an angel. A female angel. She was very strange. She was old and young together,
she went on, forgetting that that was how she herself appeared to Mary.
Her name was Zaphania. She told me many things. She said that all the history of human life has been a struggle between wisdom and stupidity. She and the rebel angels, the followers of wisdom, have always tried to open minds. The authority and his churches have always tried to keep them closed. She gave me many examples from my world.
I can think of many from mine.
And for most of that time, wisdom has had to work in secret, whispering her words, moving like a spy through the humble places of the world, while the courts and palaces are occupied by her enemies.
Yes, I recognize that too.
And the struggle isn't over now, though the forces of the kingdom have met a setback. They'll regroup under a new commander and come back strongly, and we must be ready to resist.
But what happened to Lord Azrael?
He fought the regent of heaven, the angel Metatron, and he wrestled him down into the abyss. Metatron is gone forever. So is Lord Azrael.
And Mrs. Coulter?
As an answer, the witch took an arrow from her quiver. She took her time selecting it, the best, the straightest, the most perfectly balanced, and she broke it in two.
Once in my world, I saw that woman torturing a witch, and I swore to myself that I would send that arrow into her throat. Now I shall never do that. She sacrificed herself with Lord Azrael to fight the angel and make the world safe for Lyra. They could not have done it alone, but together they did it.
How can we tell Lyra?
Wait until she asks. And she might not. In any case, she has her symbol reader. That will tell her anything she wants to know.
They sat in silence for a while, companionably, as the stars slowly wheeled in the sky.
Can you see ahead and guess what they'll choose to do?
No. But if Lyra returns to her own world, then I will be her sister as long as she lives. What will you do?
Mary began, and found she hadn't considered that for a moment.
I suppose I belong in my own world, though I'll be sorry to leave this one. I've been very happy here. The happiest I've ever been in my life, I think.
Well, if you do return home, you shall have a sister in another world, and so shall I. We shall see each other again in a day or so when the ship arrives, and we'll talk more on the voyage home, and then we'll part forever. Embrace me now, sister.
Mary did so, and Serafina Pekkala flew away on her cloud pine branch over the reeds, over the marshes, over the mud flats and the beach, and over the sea, until Mary could see her no more. At about the same time, one of the large blue lizards came across the body of Father Gomez. Will and Lyra had returned to the village that afternoon by a different route, and hadn't seen it. The priest lay undisturbed where Balthamos had laid him. The lizards were scavengers, but they were mild and harmless creatures, and by an ancient understanding with the Mulefa, they were entitled to take any creature left dead after dark. The lizard dragged the priest's body back to her nest, and her children feasted very well. As for the rifle, it lay in the grass where Father Gomez had laid it down, quietly turning to rust. Chapter 37 The Dunes.
My soul, do not seek eternal life, but exhaust the realm of the possible. Pindar.
Next day, Will and Lyra went out by themselves again, speaking little, eager to be alone with each other. They looked dazed, as if some happy accident had robbed them of their wits. They moved slowly. Their eyes were not focused on what they looked at. They spent all day on the wide hills, and in the heat of the afternoon they visited their gold and silver grove. They talked, they bathed, they ate, they kissed. They lay in a trance of happiness, murmuring words whose sound was as confused as their sense, and they felt they were melting with love. In the evening they shared the meal with Mary and Atal, saying little, and because the air was hot, they thought they'd walk down to the sea, where there might be a cool breeze. They wandered along the river until they came to the wide beach, bright under the moon, where the low tide was turning. They lay down in the soft sand at the foot of the dunes, and then they heard the first bird calling. They both turned their heads at once, because it was a bird that sounded like no creature that belonged to the world they were in. From somewhere above in the dark came a delicate trilling song, and then another answered it from a different direction. Delighted, Will and Lyra jumped up and tried to see the singers, but all they could make out was a pair of dark skimming shapes that flew low and then darted up again, all the time singing and singing in rich liquid bell tones and endlessly varied song. And then, with a flutter of wings that threw up a little fountain of sand in front of him, the first bird landed a few yards away. Lyra said,
"Pan?"
He was formed like a dove, but his colour was dark and hard to tell in the moonlight. At any rate, he showed up clearly on the white sand. The other bird still circled overhead, still singing, and then she flew down to join him, another dove, but pearl-white and with a crest of dark red feathers. And Will knew what it was to see his demon. As she flew down to the sand, he felt his heart tighten and release in a way he never forgot. 60 years and more would go by, and as an old man he would still feel some sensations as bright and fresh as ever. Lyra's fingers putting the fruit between his lips under the gold and silver trees, her warm mouth pressing against his demon being torn from his unsuspecting breast as they entered the world of the dead, and the sweet rightfulness of her coming back to him at the edge of the moonlit dunes. Lyra made to move towards them, but Pantalaimon spoke.
"Lyra, Serafina Pekkala came to us last night. She told us all kinds of things. She's gone back to guide the Egyptians here. Father Coram's coming, and Lord Far, and they'll be here..."
"Pan! Oh, Pan, you're not happy. What is it? What is it?"
Then he changed, and flowed over the sand to her as a snow-white ermine. The other demon changed too. Will felt it happen like a little grip at his heart, and became a cat. Before she moved to him, she spoke.
"The witch gave me a name. I had no need of one before. She called me Kiryava. But listen, listen to us now."
"Yes, you must listen,"
said Pantalaimon.
"This is hard to explain.
Between them, the demons managed to tell them everything Serafina had told them, beginning with the revelation about the children's own natures, about how, without intending it, they had become like witches in their power to separate and yet still be one being.
But that's not all.
Oh, Lyra, forgive us, but we have to tell you what we found out.
Lyra was bewildered. When had Pan ever needed forgiving? She looked at Will and saw his puzzlement as clear as her own.
Tell us. Don't be afraid.
It's about dust,
said the cat demon, and Will marvelled to hear part of his own nature telling him something he didn't know.
It was all flowing away, all the dust there was, down into the abyss that you saw. Something stopped it flowing down there, but...
Will, it was that golden light, the light that all flowed into the abyss and vanished. And that was dust? Was it really?
Yes, but there's more leaking out all the time. And it mustn't. It mustn't all leak away. It's got to stay in the world and not vanish, because otherwise everything good will fade away and die.
But where's the rest leaving from?
Both demons looked at Will and at the knife.
Every time we made an opening,
said Kiriava. And again Will felt that little thrill. She's me and I'm her.
Every time anyone made an opening between the worlds, us or the old guild men, anyone, the knife cut into the emptiness outside. The same emptiness there is down in the abyss. We never knew. No one knew, because the edge was too fine to see, but it was quite big enough for dust to leak out of. If they closed it up again at once, there wasn't time for much to leak out, but there were thousands that they never closed up. So all this time, dust has been leaking out of the worlds and into nothingness.
The understanding was beginning to dawn on Will and Lyra. They fought it, they pushed it away, but it was just like the grey light that seeps into the sky and extinguishes the stars. It crept past every barrier they could put up and under every blind and around the edges of every curtain they could draw against it.
Every opening.
Every single one. They must all be closed.
Every single one,
said Pantalaimon.
Oh, no! No! It can't be true!
And so we must leave our world to stay in Lyra's. Or Pan and Lyra must leave theirs and come to stay in ours. There's no other choice.
Then the full bleak daylight struck in. And Lyra cried aloud. Pantalaimon's owl cry the night before had frightened every small creature that heard it, but it was nothing to the passionate wail that Lyra uttered now. The demons were shocked, and Will, seeing their reaction, understood why. They didn't know the rest of the truth. They didn't know what Will and Lyra themselves had learned. Lyra was shaking with anger and grief, striding up and down with clenched fists and turning her tear-streaming face this way and that as if looking for an answer. Will jumped up and seized her shoulders and felt her tense and trembling.
Listen, Lyra, listen. What did my father say?
Oh!
She cried, tossing her head this way and that.
He said... You know what he said. You were there, Will. You listened too.
He thought she would die of her grief there and then. She flung herself into his arms and sobbed, clinging passionately to his shoulders, pressing her nails into his back and her face into his neck, and all he could hear was...
No! No! No!
Listen, Lyra, let's try and remember it exactly. There might be a way through. There might be a loophole.
He disengaged her arms gently and made her sit down. At once Pantalaimon, frightened, flowed up onto her lap, and the cat demon tentatively came close to Will. They hadn't touched yet, but now he put out a hand to her and she moved her cat face against his fingers and then stepped delicately onto his lap.
He said that people could spend a little time in other worlds without being affected. They could. And we have, haven't we? Apart from what we had to do to go into the world of the dead, we're still healthy, aren't we?
They can spend a little time, but not a long time. My father had been away from his world, my world, for 10 years. And he was nearly dying when I found him. 10 years, that's all.
But what about Lord Boreal? Sir Charles? He was healthy enough, wasn't he?
Yes, but remember, he could go back to his own world whenever he liked and get healthy again. That's where you saw him first, after all, in your world. He must have found some secret window that no one else knew about.
Well, we could do that.
We could, except that...
All the windows must be closed,
said Pantalaimon.
All of them.
But how do you know?
An angel told us,
said Kiriava.
We met an angel. She told us all about that and other things as well.
It's true, Lyra.
She? It was a female angel. I've never heard of one of them. Maybe she was lying.
Will was thinking through another possibility.
Suppose they closed all the other windows, and we just made one when we needed to, and went through as quickly as we could and closed it up immediately. That would be safe, surely. If we didn't leave much time for dust to go out?
Yes!
We'd make it where no one could ever find it, and only us two would know.
Oh, it would work. I'm sure it would.
And we could go from one to the other and stay healthy.
But the demons were distressed, and Kiriava was murmuring,
No, no.
And Pantalaimon said,
The spectres. She told us about the spectres, too.
The spectres? We saw them during the battle for the first time. What about them?
Well, we found out where they come from,
said Kiriava.
And this is the worst thing. They're like the children of the abyss. Every time we open a window with the knife, it makes a specter. It's like a little bit of the abyss that floats out and enters the world. That's why the Chittagatse world was so full of them, because of all the windows they left open there.
And they grow by feeding on dust,
said Pantalaimon.
And on demons. Because dust and demons are sort of similar. Grown-up demons, anyway. And the spectres get bigger and stronger as they do.
Will felt a dull horror at his heart, and Kiriava pressed herself against his breast, feeling it too, and trying to comfort him.
So every time I've used the knife, every single time I've made another spectre come to life.
He remembered Yorick Birnison, in the cave where he'd forged the knife again, saying, What you don't know is what the knife does on its own. Your intentions may be good. The knife has intentions too. Lyra's eyes were watching him, wide with anguish.
Oh, we can't, Will. We can't do that to people. Not let other spectres out. Not now we've seen what they do.
All right,
he said, getting to his feet, holding his demon close to his breast.
Then we'll have to. One of us will have to. I'll come to your world, and...
She knew what he was going to say, and she saw him holding the beautiful, healthy demon he hadn't even begun to know. And she thought of his mother, and she knew that he was thinking of her too. To abandon her and live with Lyra, even for the few years they'd have together. Could he do that? He might be living with Lyra, but she knew he wouldn't be able to live with himself.
No!
She cried, jumping up beside him, and Kiriava joined Pantalaimon on the sand as boy and girl clung together desperately.
I'll do it, Will. We'll come to your world and live there. It doesn't matter if we get ill, me and Pan. We're strong. I bet we last a good long time. And there are probably good doctors in your world. Dr. Malone would know. Oh, let's do that.
He was shaking his head, and she saw the brilliance of tears on his cheeks.
Do you think I could bear that, Lyra? Do you think I could live happily watching you get sick and ill and fade away and then die? While I was getting stronger and more grown up day by day. 10 years. That's nothing. It'd pass in a flash. We'd be in our 20s. It's not that far ahead. Think of that, Lyra. You and me grown up, just preparing to do all the things we want to do. And then it all comes to an end. Do you think I could bear to live on after you died? Oh, Lyra, I'd follow you down to the world of the dead without thinking twice about it, just like you followed Roger. And that would be 2 lives gone for nothing. My life wasted like yours. No, we should spend our whole lifetimes together, good, long, busy lives. And if we can't spend them together, we'll have to spend them apart.
Biting her lip, she watched him as he walked up and down in his distracted anguish. He stopped and turned.
Do you remember another thing he said, my father? He said we have to build the Republic of Heaven where we are. He said that for us there isn't any elsewhere. That's what he meant, I can see now. Oh, it's too bitter. I thought he just meant Lord Asriel and his new world, but he meant us. He meant you and me. We have to live in our own worlds.
I'm going to ask the alethiometer. That'll know. I don't know why I didn't think of it before.
She sat down, wiping her cheeks with the palm of one hand and reaching for the rucksack with the other. She carried it everywhere. When Will thought of her in later years, it was often with that little bag over her shoulder. She tucked the hair behind her ears in the swift movement he loved, and took out the black velvet bundle.
"Can you see?"
he said, for although the moon was bright, the symbols around the face were very small.
"I know where they all are. I got it off by heart. Hush now."
She crossed her legs, pulling the skirt over them to make a lap. Will lay on one elbow and watched. The bright moonlight, reflected off the white sand, lit up her face with a radiance that seemed to draw out some other radiance from inside her. Her eyes glittered, and her expression was so serious and absorbed that Will could have fallen in love with her again if love didn't already possess every fibre of his being. Lyra took a deep breath and began to turn the wheels. But after only a few moments, she stopped and turned the instrument around.
"Wrong place,"
she said briefly, and tried again. Will, watching, saw her beloved face clearly. And because he knew it so well, and he'd studied her expression in happiness and despair and hope and sorrow, he could tell that something was wrong. For there was no sign of the clear concentration she used to sink into so quickly. Instead, an unhappy bewilderment spread gradually over her. She bit her lower lip, she blinked more and more, and her eyes moved slowly from symbol to symbol, almost at random, instead of darting swiftly and certainly.
"I don't know. I don't know what's happening. I know it so well, but I can't seem to see what it means."
She took a deep, shuddering breath and turned the instrument around. It looked strange and awkward in her hands. Pantalaimon, mouse-formed, crept into her lap and rested his black paws on the crystal, peering at one symbol after another. Lyra turned one wheel, turned another, turned the whole thing around, and then looked up at Will, stricken.
"Oh, Will, I can't do it. It's left me."
"Hush. Don't fret. It's still there inside you, all that knowledge. Just be calm and let yourself find it. Don't force it. Just sort of float down to touch it."
She gulped and nodded and angrily brushed her wrist across her eyes and took several deep breaths, but he could see she was too tense, and he put his hands on her shoulders and then felt her trembling and hugged her tight. She pulled back and tried again. Once more she gazed at the symbols, once more she turned the wheels, but those invisible ladders of meaning down which she'd stepped with such ease and confidence weren't there. She just didn't know what any of the symbols meant. She turned away and clung to Will and said desperately,
"It's no good. I can tell. It's gone forever. It just came when I needed it, for all the things I had to do, for rescuing Roger, and then for us two. And now that it's over, now that everything's finished, it's just left me. It's gone, Will. I've lost it. It'll never come back."
She sobbed with desperate abandon. All he could do was hold her. He didn't know how to comfort her, because it was plain that she was right. Then both the demons bristled and looked up. Will and Lyra sensed it too and followed their eyes to the sky. A light was moving towards them, a light with wings.
"It's the angel we saw,"
said Pantalaimon, guessing. He guessed correctly. As the boy and the girl and the two demons watched her approach, Zaphania spread her wings wider and glided down to the sand. Will, for all the time he'd spent in the company of Balthamos, wasn't prepared for the strangeness of this encounter. He and Lyra held each other's hands tightly as the angel came towards them, with the light of another world shining on her. She was unclothed, but that meant nothing. What clothes could an angel wear anyway, Lyra thought. It was impossible to tell if she was old or young, but her expression was austere and compassionate, and both Will and Lyra felt as if she knew them to their hearts.
"Will, I have come to ask your help."
"My help? How can I help you?"
"I want you to show me how to close the openings that the knife makes."
"I'll show you. And in return, can you help us?"
"Not in the way you want. I can see what you've been talking about. Your sorrow has left traces in the air. This is no comfort, but believe me, every single being who knows of your dilemma wishes things could be otherwise. But there are fates that even the most powerful have to submit to. There is nothing I can do to help you change the way things are."
Why can't I read the alethiometer anymore? Why can't I even do that? That was the one thing I could do really well, and it's just not there anymore.
It just vanished as if it had never come.
You read it by grace, and you can regain it by work.
How long will that take?
A lifetime.
That long?
But your reading will be even better then, after a lifetime of thought and effort, because it will come from conscious understanding. Grace attained like that is deeper and fuller than grace that comes freely. And furthermore, once you've gained it, it will never leave you.
You mean a full lifetime, don't you? A whole long life, not just a few years.
Yes, I do.
And must all the windows be closed? Every single one?
Understand this. Dust is not a constant. There's not a fixed quantity that has always been the same. Conscious beings make dust. They renew it all the time, by thinking and feeling and reflecting, by gaining wisdom and passing it on. And if you help everyone else in your worlds to do that, by helping them to learn and understand about themselves and each other and the way everything works, and by showing them how to be kind instead of cruel, and patient instead of hasty, and cheerful instead of surly, and above all, how to keep their minds open and free and curious, then they will renew enough to replace what is lost through one window. So there could be one left open.
Will trembled with excitement, and his mind leapt to a single point, to a new window in the air between his world and Lyra's. And it would be their secret, and they could go through whenever they chose, and live for a while in each other's worlds, not living fully in either, so their demons would keep their health. And they could grow up together, and maybe much later on they might have children who would be secret citizens of two worlds. And they could bring all the learning of one world into the other. They could do all kinds of good. But Lyra was shaking her head.
No, we can't, Will.
And he suddenly knew her thought.
No, the dead.
We must leave it open for them. We must.
Yes, otherwise...
And we must make enough dust for them, Will, and keep the window open.
She was trembling. She felt very young as he held her to his side.
And if we do, if we live our lives properly and think about them as we do, then there'll be something to tell the harpies about as well. We've got to tell people that, Lyra.
The true stories, yes. The true stories the harpies want to hear in exchange, yes. So if people live their whole lives and they've got nothing to tell about it when they finish, then they'll never leave the world of the dead. We've got to tell them that, Will.
Alone, though.
Yes. Alone.
And at the word alone, Will felt a great wave of rage and despair moving outwards from a place deep within him, as if his mind were an ocean that some profound convulsion had disturbed. All his life he'd been alone, and now he must be alone again, and this infinitely precious blessing that had come to him must be taken away almost at once. He felt the wave build higher and steeper to darken the sky. He felt the crest tremble and begin to spill. He felt the great mass crashing down with the whole weight of the ocean behind it against the iron-bound coast of what had to be. And he found himself gasping and shaking and crying aloud with more anger and pain than he had ever felt in his life, and he found Lyra just as helpless in his arms. But as the wave expended its force and the waters withdrew, the bleak rocks remained. There was no arguing with fate. Neither his despair nor Lyra's had moved them a single inch. How long his rage lasted, he had no idea. But eventually it had to subside, and the ocean was a little calmer after the convulsion. The waters were still agitated, and perhaps they would never be truly calm again, but the great force had gone. They turned to the angel and saw she had understood, and that she felt as sorrowful as they did. But she could see further than they could, and there was a calm hope in her expression, too. Will swallowed hard and said,
All right, I'll show you how to close a window, but I'll have to open one first and make another spectre. I never knew about them, or else I'd have been more careful.
We shall take care of the spectres,
said Zephania. Will took the knife and faced the sea. To his surprise, his hands were quite steady. He cut a window into his own world, and they found themselves looking at a great factory or chemical plant, where complicated pipework ran between buildings and storage tanks, where lights glowed at every corner, where wisps of steam rose into the air.
It's strange to think that angels don't know the way to do this.
The knife was a human invention.
And you're going to close them all, except one? All except the one from the world of the dead?
Yes, that is a promise. But it is conditional, and you know the condition.
Yes, we do. Are there many windows to close?
Thousands. There is the terrible abyss made by the bomb, and there is the great opening Lord Asriel made out of his own world. They must both be closed, and they will. But there are many smaller openings too, some deep under the earth, some high in the air, which came about in other ways.
Baruch and Balthamas told me that they used openings like that to travel between the worlds. Will angels no longer be able to do that? Will you be confined to one world as we are?
No, we have other ways of travelling.
The way you have? Is it possible for us to learn?
Yes, you could learn to do it, as Will's father did. It uses the faculty of what you call imagination. But that does not mean making things up. It is a form of seeing.
Not real travelling, then? Just pretend?
No. Nothing like pretend. Pretending is easy. This way is hard, but much truer.
And is it like the alethiometer? Does it take a whole lifetime to learn?
It takes long practice, yes. You have to work. Did you think you could snap your fingers and have it as a gift? What is worth having is worth working for. But you have a friend who has already taken the first steps and who could help you.
Will had no idea who that could be, and at that moment he wasn't in the mood to ask.
I see. And will we see you again? Will we ever speak to an angel once we go back to our own worlds?
I don't know. But you should not spend your time waiting.
And I should break the knife.
Yes.
While they had been speaking, the window had been opened beside them. The lights were glowing in the factory. The work was going on. Machines were turning. Chemicals were combining. People were producing goods and earning their livings. That was the world where Will belonged.
Well, I'll show you what to do.
So he taught the angel how to feel for the edges of the window, just as Giacomo Paradisi had shown him, sensing them at his fingers' ends and pinching them together. Little by little, the window closed and the factory disappeared.
The openings that weren't made by the subtle knife, is it really necessary to close them all? Because surely dust only escapes through the openings the knife made. The other ones must have been there for thousands of years and still dust exists.
We shall close them all. Because if you thought that any still remained, you would spend your life searching for one, and that would be a waste of the time you have. You have other work than that to do, much more important and valuable in your own world. There will be no travel outside it any more.
What work have I got to do, then? No. On second thought, don't tell me. I shall decide what I do. If you say my work is fighting, or healing, or exploring, or whatever you might say, I'll always be thinking about it. And if I do end up doing that, I'll be resentful because it'll feel as if I didn't have a choice. And if I don't do it, I'll feel guilty because I should. Whatever I do, I will choose it. No one else.
Then you have already taken the first steps toward wisdom.
There's a light out at sea!
That is the ship bringing your friends to take you home. They will be here tomorrow.
The word tomorrow fell like a heavy blow. Lyra had never thought she would be reluctant to see Father Coram and John Farr and Serafina Pekela.
I shall go now. I have learnt what I needed to know.
She embraced each of them in her light, cool arms and kissed their foreheads. Then she bent to kiss the demons, and they became birds and flew up with her as she spread her wings and rose swiftly into the air. Only a few seconds later she had vanished. A few moments after she had gone, Lyra gave a little gasp.
What is it?
I never asked her about my father and mother, and I can't ask the alethiometer either now. I wonder if I'll ever know.
She sat down slowly, and he sat down beside her.
Oh, Will, what can we do? Whatever can we do? I want to live with you forever. I want to kiss you and lie down with you and wake up with you every day of my life till I die, years and years and years away. I don't want a memory, just a memory.
No, memory's a poor thing to have. It's your own real hair and mouth and arms and eyes and hands I want. I didn't know I could ever love anything so much. Oh, Lyra, I wish this night would never end. If only we could stay here like this, and the world could stop turning, and everyone else could fall into a sleep.
Everyone except us. And you and I could live here forever and just love each other.
I will love you forever, whatever happens. Till I die, and after I die, and when I find my way out of the land of the dead, I'll drift about forever, all my atoms, till I find you again.
I'll be looking for you, Will, every moment, every single moment. And when we do find each other again, we'll cling together so tight that nothing and no one will ever tear us apart. Every atom of me and every atom of you will live in birds and flowers and dragonflies and pine trees and in clouds and in those little specks of light you see floating in sunbeams. And when they use our atoms to make new lives, they won't just be able to take one. They'll have to take two. One of you and one of me will be joined so tight.
They lay side by side, hand in hand, looking at the sky.
Do you remember when you first came into that cafe in Chigatse and you'd never seen a demon?
I couldn't understand what he was. But when I saw you, I liked you straight away because you were brave.
No, I liked you first.
You didn't. You fought me.
Well, yes, but you attacked me.
I did not. You came charging out and attacked me.
Yes, but I soon stopped.
Yes, but...
He felt her tremble, and then under his hands the delicate bones of her back began to rise and fall, and he heard her sob quietly. He stroked her warm hair, her tender shoulders, and then he kissed her face again and again, and presently she gave a deep, shuddering sigh and fell still. The demons flew back down now and changed again and came towards them over the soft sand. Lyra sat up to greet them, and Will marvelled at the way he could instantly tell which demon was which, never mind what form they had. Pantalaimon was now an animal whose name he couldn't quite find, like a large and powerful ferret, red-gold in colour, lithe and sinuous and full of grace. Kiriava was a cat again, but she was a cat of no ordinary size, and her fur was lustrous and rich, with a thousand different glints and shades of ink-black, shadow-grey, the blue of a deep lake under a noon sky, mist, lavender, moonlight, fog. To see the meaning of the word subtlety, you had only to look at her fur.
A marten,
he said, finding the name for Pantalaimon.
A pine marten.
Pan,
Lyra said as he flowed up onto her lap.
You're not going to change a lot anymore, are you?
No.
It's funny. You remember when we were younger, and I didn't want you to stop changing at all. Well, I wouldn't mind so much now. Not if you stay like this.
Will put his hand on hers. A new mood had taken hold of him, and he felt resolute and peaceful. Knowing exactly what he was doing and exactly what it would mean, he moved his hand from Lyra's wrist and stroked the red-gold fur of her demon. Lyra gasped. But her surprise was mixed with a pleasure so like the joy that flooded through her when she had put the fruit to his lips that she couldn't protest because she was breathless. With a racing heart, she responded in the same way. She put her hand on the silky warmth of Will's demon, and as her fingers tightened in the fur, she knew that Will was feeling exactly what she was. And she knew, too, that neither demon would change now, having felt a lover's hands on them. These were their shapes for life. They would want no other. So, wondering whether any lovers before them had made this blissful discovery, they lay together as the earth turned slowly and the moon and stars blazed above them. Chapter 38. The Botanic Garden. The Egyptians arrived on the afternoon of the following day. There was no harbour, of course, so they had to anchor the ship some way out, and John Farr, Farr Coram, and the captain came ashore in a launch with Serafina Pekala as their guide. Mary had told the Mulefa everything she knew, and by the time the Egyptians were stepping ashore onto the wide beach, there was a curious crowd waiting to greet them. Each side, of course, was on fire with curiosity about the other, but John Farr had learned plenty of courtesy and patience in his long life, and he was determined that these strangest of all people should receive nothing but grace and friendship from the Lord of the Western Egyptians. So he stood in the hot sun for some time while Satamax, the old Zalif, made a speech of welcome, which Mary translated as best she could. And John Farr replied, bringing them greetings from the fens and the waterways of his homeland. When they began to move up through the marshes to the village, the Mulefa saw how hard it was for Farr Coram to walk, and at once they offered to carry him. He accepted gratefully, and so it was that they came to the gathering ground, where Will and Lyra came to meet them. Such an age had gone past since Lyra had seen these dear men. They'd last spoken together in the snows of the Arctic, on their way to rescue the children from the gobblers. She was almost shy, and she offered her hand to shake, uncertainly. But John Farr caught her up in a tight embrace and kissed both her cheeks, and Farr Coram did the same, gazing at her before folding her tight to his chest.
"She's growed up, John,"
he said.
"Remember that little girl we took to the Northlands? Look at her now, eh? Lyra, my dear, if I had the tongue of an angel, I couldn't tell you how glad I am to set eyes on you again."
But she looks so hurt, he thought. She looks so frail and weary. And neither he nor John Farr could miss the way she stayed close to Will, and how the boy with the straight black eyebrows was aware every second of where she was and made sure he never strayed far from her. The old men greeted him respectfully, because Serafina Pekala had told them something of what Will had done. For Will's part, he admired the massive power of Lord Farr's presence, power tempered by courtesy, and he thought that that would be a good way to behave when he himself was old. John Farr was a shelter and a strong refuge.
"Dr. Malone," said John Farr, "we need to take on fresh water and whatever in the way of food your friends can sell us. Besides, our men have been on board ship for a fair while, and we've had some fighting to do, and it would be a blessing if they could all have a run ashore so they can breathe the air of this land and tell their families at home about the world they voyaged to."
"Lord Farr,"
said Mary,
"the Mulefa have asked me to say they will supply everything you need, and that they would be honoured if you could all join them this evening to share their meal."
"It'll be our great pleasure to accept."
So that evening the people of three worlds sat down together and shared bread and meat and fruit and wine. Egyptians presented their hosts with gifts from all the corners of their world, with crocks of Geneva, carvings of walrus ivory, silken tapestries from Turkestan, cups of silver from the mines of Sweden, enameled dishes from Korea. The Mulefa received them with delight, and in return offered objects of their own workmanship, rare vessels of ancient knotwood, lengths of the finest rope and cord, lacquered bowls, and fishing nets so strong and light that even the fen-dwelling Egyptians had never seen the like. Having shared the feast, the captain thanked his hosts and left to supervise the crew as they took on board the stores and water that they needed, because they meant to sail as soon as morning came. While they were doing that, the old Zalif said to his guests,
"A great change has come over everything, and as a token, we have been granted a responsibility. We would like to show you what this means."
So John Farr, Farr Coram, Mary and Serafina went with them to the place where the land of the dead opened, and where the ghosts were coming out, still in their endless procession. The Mulefa were planting a grove around it because it was a holy place, they said. They would maintain it forever. It was a source of joy.
"Well, this is a mystery,"
said Farr Coram,
"and I'm glad I lived long enough to see it. To go into the dark of death is a thing we all fear. Say what we like, we fear it. But if there's a way out, for that part of us that has to go down there, then it makes my heart lighter."
"You're right, Coram," said John Farr. "I've seen a good many folk die. I've sent more than a few men down into the dark myself, though it was always in the anger of battle. To know that, after a spell in the dark, we'll come out again to a sweet land like this, to be free of the sky like the birds. Well, that's the greatest promise anyone could wish for.
We must talk to Lyra about this,
said Father Coram,
and learn how it came about, and what it means.
Mary found it very hard to say goodbye to Atal and the other Mulefa. Before she boarded the ship, they gave her a gift, a lacquer phial containing some of the wheel tree oil, and, most precious of all, a little bag of seeds.
They might not grow in your world,
Atal said.
But if not, you have the oil. Don't forget us, Mary.
Never,
Mary said.
Never. If I live as long as the witches and forget everything else, I'll never forget you and the kindness of your people, Atal.
So the journey home began. The wind was light, the seas were calm, and although they saw the glitter of those great snow-white wings more than once, the birds were wary and stayed well clear. Will and Lyra spent every hour together, and for them the 2 weeks of the voyage passed like the blink of an eyelid. Zaphania had told Serafina Pekala that when all the openings were closed, then the worlds would all be restored to their proper relations with one another, and Lyra's Oxford and Will's would lie over each other again, like transparent images on two sheets of film being moved closer and closer until they merged, although they would never truly touch. At the moment, however, they were a long way apart, as far as Lyra had had to travel from her Oxford to Chitagatse. Will's Oxford was here now, just a knife cut away. It was evening when they arrived, and as the anchor splashed into the water, the late sun lay warmly on the green hills, the terracotta roofs, that elegant and crumbling waterfront, and Will and Lyra's little cafe. A long search through the captain's telescope had shown no signs of life whatsoever, but John Farr planned to take half a dozen armed men ashore just in case. They wouldn't get in the way, but they were there if they were needed. They ate a last meal together, watching the darkness fall. Will said goodbye to the captain and his officers, and to John Farr and Father Coram. He had hardly seemed to be aware of them, and they saw him more clearly than he saw them. They saw someone young, but very strong, and deeply stricken. Finally, Will and Lyra and their demons, and Mary and Serafina Pekala, set off through the empty city. And it was empty. The only footfalls and the only shadows were their own. Lyra and Will went ahead, hand in hand, to the place where they had to part, and the women stayed some way behind, talking like sisters.
Lyra wants to come a little way into my Oxford,
Mary said.
She's got something in mind. She'll come straight back afterwards.
What will you do, Mary?
Me? Go with Will, of course. We'll go to my flat, my house, tonight. And then tomorrow, we'll go and find out where his mother is and see what we can do to help her get better. There are so many rules and regulations in my world, Serafina. You have to satisfy the authorities and answer 1,000 questions. I'll help him with all the legal side of things, and the social services and housing and all that, and let him concentrate on his mother. He's a strong boy, but I'll help him. Besides, I need him. I haven't got a job anymore and not much money in the bank, and I wouldn't be surprised if the police are after me. He'll be the only person in my whole world that I can talk to about all this.
They walked on through the silent streets, past a square tower with a doorway opening into darkness, past a little cafe where tables stood on the pavement, and out onto a broad boulevard with a line of palm trees in the centre.
This is where I came through.
The window Will had first seen in the quiet suburban road in Oxford opened here, and on the Oxford side it was guarded by police, or had been when Mary tricked them into letting her through. She saw Will reach the spot and move his hands deftly in the air, and the window vanished.
That'll surprise them next time they look.
It was Lyra's intention to go into Will and Mary's Oxford and show Will something before returning with Serafina, and obviously they had to be careful where they cut through. So the women followed on behind through the moonlit streets of Chitagatse. On their right, a wide and graceful parkland led up to a great house with a classical portico as brilliant as icing sugar under the moon.
When you told me the shape of my demon,
Mary said,
you said you could teach me how to see him if we had time. I wish we had.
Well, we have had time,
Seraphina said.
And haven't we been talking? I've taught you some witch lore, which would be forbidden under the old ways in my world. But you are going back to your world, and the old ways have changed, and I, too, have learnt much from you. Now then, when you spoke to the shadows on your computer, you had to hold a special state of mind, didn't you?
Yes, just as Lyra did with the alethiometer. Do you mean if I try that?
Not only that, but ordinary seeing at the same time. Try it now.
In Mary's world, they had a kind of picture that looked at first like random dots of colour, but that, when you looked at it in a certain way, seemed to advance into three dimensions. There in front of the paper would be a tree, or a face, or something else surprisingly solid that simply wasn't there before. What Seraphina taught Mary to do now was similar to that. She had to hold on to her normal way of looking, while simultaneously slipping into the trance-like open dreaming in which she could see the shadows. But now she had to hold both ways together, the everyday and the trance, just as you have to look in two directions at once to see the 3D pictures among the dots. And just as it happens with the dot pictures, she suddenly got it.
Oh!
She cried, and reached for Seraphina's arm to steady herself, for there on the iron fence around the parkland sat a bird. Glossy black, with red legs and a curved yellow bill, an alpine chough, just as Seraphina had described. He was only a foot or two away, watching her with his head slightly cocked, for all the world as though he was amused. But she was so surprised that her concentration slipped, and he vanished.
You've done it once, and next time it will be easier. When you are in your world, you will learn to see the demons of other people too, in the same way. They won't see yours, or Will's, though, unless you teach them as I've taught you.
Yes. Oh, this is extraordinary. Yes.
Mary thought, Lyra talked to her demon, didn't she? Would she hear this bird as well as see him? She walked on, glowing with anticipation. Ahead of them, Will was cutting a window, and he and Lyra waited for the women to pass through so that he could close it again.
Do you know where we are?
Mary looked around. The road they were in now, in her world, was quiet and tree-lined, with big Victorian houses in shrub-filled gardens.
Somewhere in North Oxford. Not far from my flat, as a matter of fact, though I don't know exactly which road this is.
I want to go to the Botanic Garden,
Lyra said.
All right. I suppose that's about 15 minutes' walk. This way.
Mary tried the double seeing again. She found it easier this time, and there was the chough, with her in her own world, perching on a branch that hung low over the pavement. To see what would happen, she held out her hand, and he stepped onto it without hesitation. She felt the slight weight, the tight grip of the claws on her finger, and gently moved him onto her shoulder. He settled into place as if he'd been there all her life. Well, he has, she thought, and moved on. There was not much traffic in the High Street, and when they turned down the steps opposite Magdalen College towards the gate of the Botanic Garden, they were completely alone. There was an ornate gateway with stone seats inside it, and while Mary and Seraphina sat there, Will and Lyra climbed over the iron fence into the garden itself. Their demons slipped through the bars and flowed ahead of them into the garden.
It's this way,
said Lyra, tugging at Will's hand. She led him past a pool with a fountain under a wide-spreading tree, and then struck off to the left between beds of plants towards a huge, many-trunked pine. There was a massive stone wall with a doorway in it, and in the further part of the garden, the trees were younger and the planting less formal. Lyra led him almost to the end of the garden, over a little bridge, to a wooden seat under a spreading, low-branched tree.
Yes, I hoped so much, and here it is, just the same. Well, I used to come here in my Oxford and sit on this exact same bench whenever I wanted to be alone, just me and Pan. What I thought was that if you, maybe just once a year, if we could come here at the same time, just for an hour or something, then we could pretend we were close again. Because we would be close. If you sat here, and I sat just here, in my world.
Yes. As long as I live, I'll come back. Wherever I am in the world, I'll come back here.
On Midsummer Day. At midday. As long as I live. As long as I live.
He found himself unable to see, But he let the hot tears flow and just held her close.
And if we... later on... if we meet someone that we like, and if we marry them, then we must be good to them and not make comparisons all the time and wish we were married to each other instead. But just keep up this coming here once a year. Just for an hour. Just to be together.
They held each other tightly. Minutes passed. A water bird on the river beside them stirred and called. The occasional car moved over Magdalen Bridge. Finally, they drew apart.
Well,
said Lyra softly. Everything about her in that moment was soft, and that was one of his favourite memories later on. Her tense grace made tender by the dimness, her eyes and hands, and especially her lips, infinitely soft. He kissed her again and again, and each kiss was nearer to the last one of all. Heavy and soft with love, they walked back to the gate. Mary and Serafina were waiting.
Lyra,
Will said. And she said,
Will.
He cut a window into Chitagatse. They were deep in the parkland around the great house, not far from the edge of the forest. He stepped through for the last time and looked down over the silent city, the tiled roofs gleaming in the moonlight, the tower above them, the lighted ship waiting out on the still sea. He turned to Serafina and said as steadily as he could,
Thank you, Serafina Pekala, for rescuing us at the Belvedere, and for everything else. Please be kind to Lyra for as long as she lives. I love her more than anyone has ever been loved.
In answer, the Witch Queen kissed him on both cheeks. Lyra had been whispering to Mary, and then they too embraced, and first Mary and then Will stepped through the last window, back into their own world, in the shade of the trees of the Botanic Garden. Being cheerful starts now, Will thought as hard as he could, but it was like trying to hold a fighting wolf still in his arms when it wanted to claw at his face and tear out his throat. Nevertheless, he did it, and he thought no one could see the effort it cost him. And he knew that Lyra was doing the same, and that the tightness and strain in her smile were the signs of it. Nevertheless, she smiled. One last kiss, rushed and clumsy so that they banged cheekbones, and a tear from her eye was transferred to his face. Their two demons kissed farewell, and Pantalaimon flowed over the threshold and up into Lyra's arms. And then Will began to close the window, and then it was done. The way was closed. Lyra was gone.
Now,
he said, trying to sound matter-of-fact, but having to turn away from Mary all the same.
I've got to break the knife.
He searched the air in the familiar way until he found a gap, and tried to bring to mind just what had happened before. He had been about to cut a way out of the cave, and Mrs. Coulter had suddenly and unaccountably reminded him of his mother, and the knife had broken because, he thought, it had at last met something it couldn't cut, and that was his love for her. So he tried it now, summoning an image of his mother's face as he'd last seen her, fearful and distracted in Mrs. Cooper's little hallway. But it didn't work. The knife cut easily through the air and opened into a world where they were having a rainstorm. Heavy drops hurtled through, startling them both. He closed it again quickly and stood puzzled for a moment. His demon knew what he should do and said simply,
Lyra.
Of course. He nodded, and with the knife in his right hand, he pressed with his left the spot where her tear still lay on his cheek. And this time, with a wrenching crack, the knife shattered and the blade fell in pieces to the ground, to glitter on the stones that were still wet with the rain of another universe. Will knelt to pick them up carefully, Kiriava with her cat eyes helping to find them all. Mary was shouldering her rucksack.
Well,
she said.
Well, listen now, Will. We've hardly spoken, you and I, so we're still strangers, largely. But Serafina Pekala and I made a promise to each other, and I made a promise to Lyra just now. And even if I hadn't made any other promises, I'd make a promise to you about the same thing, which is that, if you'll let me, I'll be your friend for the rest of our lives. We're both on our own, and I reckon we could both do with that sort of... What I mean to say is, there isn't anyone else we can talk to about all this except each other. And we've both got to get used to living with our demons, too. And we're both in trouble, and if... that doesn't give us something in common, I don't know what will.
You're in trouble,
said Will, looking at her. Her open, friendly, clever face looked back directly.
Well, I smashed up some property in the lab before I left. And I forged an identity card and... It's nothing we can't deal with. And your trouble, we can deal with that too. We can find your mother and get her some proper treatment. And if you need somewhere to live... Well, if you wouldn't mind living with me, if we can arrange that, then you won't have to go into... whatever they call it. Into care. I mean, we'll have to decide on a story and stick to it. But we could do that, couldn't we?
Mary was a friend. He had a friend. It was true. He'd never thought of that.
Yes,
he said.
Well, let's do it. My flat's about half a mile away. And you know what I'd like most of all in the world? I'd like a cup of tea. Come on, let's go and put the kettle on.
3 weeks after the moment Lyra had watched Will's hand closing his world away forever, she found herself seated once more at that dinner table in Jordan College where she had first fallen under the spell of Mrs. Coulter. This time it was a smaller party, just herself and the master and Dame Hannah Ralph, the head of St. Sophia's, one of the women's colleges. Dame Hannah had been at that first dinner too, and if Lyra was surprised to see her here now, she greeted her politely and found that her memory was at fault. For this Dame Hannah was much cleverer and more interesting and kindlier by far than the dim and frumpy person she remembered. All kinds of things had happened while Lyra was away. To Jordan College, to England, to the whole world. It seemed that the power of the church had increased greatly and that many brutal laws had been passed, but that the power had waned as quickly as it had grown. Upheavals in the magisterium had toppled the zealots and brought more liberal factions into power. The General Oblation Board had been dissolved. The Consistorial Court of Discipline was confused and leaderless. And the colleges of Oxford, after a brief and turbulent interlude, were settling back into the calm of scholarship and ritual. Some things had gone. The master's valuable collection of silver had been looted. Some college servants had vanished. The master's manservant, Cousins, was still in place, however, and Lyra had been ready to meet his hostility with defiance, for they had been enemies as long as she could remember. She was quite taken aback when he greeted her so warmly and shook her hand with both of his. Was that affection in his voice? Well, he had changed. During dinner, the master and Dame Hannah talked of what had happened in Lyra's absence, and she listened in dismay or sorrow or wonder. When they withdrew to his sitting room for coffee, the master said,
Now, Lyra, we've hardly heard from you, but I know you've seen many things. Are you able to tell us something of what you've experienced?
Yes, but not all at once. I don't understand some of it, and some makes me shudder and cry still. But I will tell you, I promise, as much as I can. Only you have to promise something too.
The master looked at the grey-haired lady with the marmoset demon in her lap, and a flicker of amusement passed between them.
What's that?
Said Dame Hannah.
You have to promise to believe me,
Lyra said seriously.
I know I haven't always told the truth, and I could only survive in some places by telling lies and making up stories. So I know that's what I've been like, and I know you know it. But my true story's too important for me to tell, if you're only going to believe half of it. So I promise to tell the truth, if you promise to believe it.
Well, I promise.
And so do I.
But you know the thing I wish? Almost more than anything else? I wish I hadn't lost the way of reading the alethiometer. Oh, it was so strange, Master, how it came in the first place and then just left. One day I knew it so well, I could move up and down the symbol meanings and step from one to another and make all the connections. It was like... Well, I was like a monkey in the trees, it was so quick. Then suddenly, nothing. None of it made sense. I couldn't even remember anything except just basic meanings, like the anchor means hope and the skull means death. All those thousands of meanings gone.
They're not gone, though, Lyra. The books are still in Bodley's library. The scholarship to study them is alive and well.
Dame Hannah was sitting opposite the master in one of the two armchairs beside the fireplace, Lyra on the sofa between them. The lamp by the master's chair was all the light there was, but it showed the expressions of the two old people clearly. And it was Dame Hannah's face that Lyra found herself studying. Kindly, Lyra thought, and sharp and wise. But she could no more read what it meant than she could read the alethiometer.
Well now, we must think about your future, Lyra.
His words made her shiver. She gathered herself and sat up.
All the time I was away, I never thought about that. All I thought about was just the time I was in, just the present. There were plenty of times when I thought I didn't have a future at all. And now, well, suddenly finding I've got a whole life to live, but no idea what to do with it. Well, it's like having the alethiometer, but no idea how to read it. I suppose I'll have to work, but I don't know at what. My parents are probably rich, but I bet they never thought of putting any money aside for me. And anyway, I think they must have used all their money up by now, so even if I did have a claim on it, there wouldn't be any left. I don't know, Master. I came back to Jordan because this used to be my home, and I didn't have anywhere else to go. I think King Yorick Bernison would let me live on Svalbard, and I think Seraphina Pekala would let me live with her witch clan. But I'm not a bear and I'm not a witch, so I wouldn't really fit in there, much as I love them. Maybe the Egyptians would take me in. But really, I don't know what to do anymore. I'm lost, really, now.
They looked at her. Her eyes were glittering more than usual. Her chin was held high with a look she'd learned from Will without knowing it. She looked defiant as well as lost, Dame Hannah thought, and admired her for it. And the master saw something else. He saw how the child's unconscious grace had gone, and how she was awkward in her growing body. But he loved the girl dearly, and he felt half proud and half in awe of the beautiful adult she would be, so soon.
You will never be lost while this college is standing, Lyra. This is your home for as long as you need it. As for money, your father made over an endowment to care for all your needs, and appointed me executor, so you needn't worry about that.
In fact, Lord Asriel had done nothing of the sort, but Jordan College was rich, and the master had money of his own, even after the recent upheavals.
No, I was thinking about learning. You're still very young, and your education until now has depended on, well, quite frankly, on which of our scholars you intimidated least. It's been haphazard. Now, it may turn out that in due course your talents will take you in a direction we can't foresee at all. But if you were to make the alethiometer the subject of your life's work, and set out to learn consciously what you could once do by intuition...
Yes.
Then you could hardly do better than put yourself in the hands of my good friend Dame Hannah. Her scholarship in that field is unmatched.
Let me make a suggestion, and you needn't respond now. Think about it for a while. Now... My college is not as old as Jordan, and you're too young yet to become an undergraduate in any case. But a few years ago we acquired a large house in North Oxford, and we decided to set up a boarding school. I'd like you to come and meet the headmistress, and see whether you'd care to become one of our pupils. You see, one thing you'll need soon, Lyra, is the friendship of other girls of your age. There are things that we learn from one another when we're young, and I don't think that Jordan can provide quite all of them. The headmistress is a clever young woman, energetic, imaginative, kindly. We're lucky to have her. You can talk to her, and if you like the idea, come and make St. Sophia's your school, as Jordan is your home. And if you'd like to begin studying the alethiometer systematically... You and I could meet for some private lessons. But there's time, my dear. There's plenty of time. Don't answer me now. Leave it until you're ready.
Thank you. Thank you, Dame Hannah. I will.
The master had given Lyra her own key to the garden door so she could come and go as she pleased. Later that night, just as the porter was locking the lodge, she and Pantalaimon slipped out and made their way through the dark streets, hearing all the bells of Oxford chiming midnight. Once they were in the Botanic Garden, Pan ran away over the grass chasing a mouse towards the wall, and then let it go and sprang up into the huge pine tree nearby. It was delightful to see him leaping through the branches so far from her, but they had to be careful not to do it when anyone was looking. Their painfully acquired witch power of separating had to stay a secret. Once she would have revelled in showing it off to all her urchin friends and making them goggle with fear, but Will had taught her the value of silence and discretion. She sat on the bench and waited for Pan to come to her. He liked to surprise her, but she usually managed to see him before he reached her, and there was his shadowy form flowing along beside the riverbank. She looked the other way and pretended she hadn't seen him, and then seized him suddenly when he leapt onto the bench.
I nearly did it.
You'll have to get better than that. I heard you coming all the way from the gate.
He sat on the back of the bench with his forepaws resting on her shoulder.
What are we going to tell her?
Yes. It's only to meet this headmistress anyway. It's not to go to the school.
But we will go, won't we?
Yes, probably.
It might be good.
Lyra wondered about the other pupils. They might be cleverer than she was, or more sophisticated, and they were sure to know a lot more than she did about all the things that were important to girls of their age, and she wouldn't be able to tell them a hundredth of the things that she knew. They'd be bound to think she was simple and ignorant.
Do you think Dame Hannah can really do the alethiometer?
With the books, I'm sure she can. I wonder how many books there are. I bet we could learn them all, and do without. Imagine having to carry a pile of books everywhere. Pan?
What?
Will you ever tell me what you and Will's demon did while we were apart?
One day. And she'll tell Will one day. We agreed that we'd know when the time had come, but we wouldn't tell either of you till then.
All right.
She had told Pantalaimon everything. But it was right that he should have some secrets from her, after the way she'd abandoned him. And it was comforting to think that she and Will had another thing in common. She wondered whether there would ever come an hour in her life when she didn't think of him, didn't speak to him in her head, didn't relive every moment they'd been together, didn't long for his voice and his hands and his love. She had never dreamed of what it would feel like to love someone so much. Of all the things that had astonished her in her adventures, that was what astonished her the most. She thought the tenderness it left in her heart was like a bruise that would never go away, but she would cherish it forever. Pan slipped down to the bench and curled up on her lap. They were safe together in the dark, she and her demon and their secrets. Somewhere in this sleeping city were the books that would tell her how to read the alethiometer again, and the kindly and learned woman who was going to teach her, and the girls at the school, who knew so much more than she did. She thought, they don't know it yet, but they're going to be my friends. Pantalaimon murmured,
that thing that Will said.
When?
On the beach. Just before you tried the alethiometer. He said there wasn't any elsewhere. It was what his father had told you. But there was something else.
I remember. He meant the kingdom was over. The kingdom of heaven. It was all finished. We shouldn't live as if it mattered more than this life in this world, because where we are is always the most important place.
He said we had to build something.
That's why we needed our full life, Pan. We would have gone with Will and Kiriava, wouldn't we?
Yes, of course. And they would have come with us, but...
But then we wouldn't have been able to build it. No one could if they put themselves first. We have to be all those difficult things, like cheerful and kind and curious and patient, and we've got to study and think and work hard, all of us, in all our different worlds. And then we'll build...
Her hands were resting on his glossy fur. Somewhere in the garden, a nightingale was singing, and a little breeze touched her hair and stirred the leaves overhead. All the different bells of the city chimed. Once each, this one high, that one low, some close by, others further off. One cracked and peevish, another grave and sonorous, but agreeing in all their different voices on what the time was, even if some of them got to it a little more slowly than others. In that other Oxford where she and Will had kissed goodbye, the bells would be chiming too, and a nightingale would be singing, and a little breeze would be stirring the leaves in the Botanic Garden.
And then what?
Said her demon sleepily.
Build what?
The Republic of Heaven,
said Lyra.
That is the end of The Amber Spyglass, written and narrated by Philip Pullman. The Amber Spyglass is the final part of a trilogy called His Dark Materials. The first part was called The Golden Compass. The second part was called The Subtle Knife. Featured in the cast were Joanna Wyatt as Lyra, Peter England as Will, Alec McCowan as Balthamus, Sean Barrett as Yorick and Lord Asriel, Alison Dowling as Mrs. Coulter, David Timson as Tialis, and Danica Fairman as Salmakia. Also featured were Susan Sheridan as Serafina Pecola and Roger, Stephen Thorne as the Inquirer, Satamax, and Farda Corum, Douglas Blackwell as Otyet Semyon, the Boatman, and John Farr, Kate Locke as Mary Malone, Alex Norton as Father MacPhail, Stephen Greif as Metatron, Eve Karpf as Zephania, and Richard Pierce as Pantalaimon. Special guests in the cast were Nigel Anthony as Fra Pavel, Nigel Carrington is the Angel Baruch, Bert Caesar is King O'Gunway, Ken Drury is Lyra's Death, Rupert Degas is Peter, Teresa Gallagher is Atal and Arma, Emmidine Verno is Angelica, and David Graham is Pagsim Tulku. Nigel Lambert was heard as the Galavespian Lord Roke, and Jill Schilling was the voice of the Harpy, No Name. The ghosts of John Perry and Lee Scoresby were performed by James Green and Garrick Hagen. Heywood Morse played Mr. Basilides, Anne Rosenfeld, Dame Hannah, and Andrew Branch was Father Gomez and Dr. Cooper. Kiriava was played by Jane Collingwood, Stel Maria and Madame Oxenteel by Liza Ross, and The Teacher and the Thin Man by John O'Connor. The children were Harriet Butler, Laura Donovan, Andrew Lamont, Fiona Lamont, Alexander Mitchell, and Arthur Mitchell. Other roles were played by members of the cast. The executive producers of this recording were Timothy P. Ditlow and Orly Moskowitz. It was recorded at Motivation Sound Studios in London, England, where the engineer was Mark Smith and the assistant director, Andrew Branch. Wolfgang Dienst was the post-production editor, and the music was composed by Peter Ponson. This has been a Story Circle production, directed by Garrick Hagen for Listening Library, an imprint of the Random House Audio Publishing Group. Text copyright 2000 by Philip Pullman. Production copyright 2001, Random House Incorporated. All rights reserved.